When survivors are believed, resourced and protected, power shifts from domination toward autonomy.
Lent Talks on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds starts on Sunday evening at 7:45.
Good morning. It's 6 o'clock on Wednesday, the 18th of February. This is Today with Justin Webb and Emma Barnett.
The headlines this morning. The National Crime Agency has issued a warning that children are facing a worsening threat from online sexual abuse, with the number of arrests rising sharply to 1,000 every month. And one of the UK's leading psychiatrists has said there's a silent mental health pandemic in England because services are overwhelmed.
We'll be speaking to her. Also in today's programme, a new exhibition celebrates this moment.
All right, so here we are, one of the elephants. And the cool thing about these guys is that they have really, really, really long trunks.
It may not have been of Sir David Attenborough's level, but that is the first video on YouTube of its co-founder at a zoo, commentating around elephants. It was a moment, though. We'll be delving into two decades of digital history. And let me tell you this, Skimo, do you know what I'm talking about? It's having its debut at the Winter Olympics today. We'll hear how skiing and mountaineering combine in this new sport. And could this be the key to a UK win at Eurovision? That's what's up. The BBC News is read by Caroline Nichols.
The National Crime Agency has warned the threat to children from online sexual abuse is getting worse, with the number of arrests rising sharply to 1,000 every month. The agency is urging tech companies to step up efforts to tackle the abuse, warning that many images are being found on mainstream platforms and social media. Our correspondent, Nomia Iqbal, has more details.
The National Crime Agency says these horrific crimes aren't just being carried out on the dark web, but on mainstream platforms online. It has found offenders have been commissioning live-stream sexual abuse of children, mainly young boys, on demand for as little as £20. It says algorithms push many abusers into parts of the online world where their behaviour is normalised and then escalates. It says police can't combat the problem alone, and it wants technology companies to do more. This includes making their platforms hostile for offenders and introducing safeguards to stop children from taking, sharing or viewing nude images.
The chief executive of Meta, Mark Zuckerberg, is due to give evidence in a Los Angeles court this afternoon in a landmark civil trial about the impact of social media on young people. Meta owns Facebook, Instagram and WhatsApp. The case has been brought by a woman and her mother who accuse Instagram and YouTube of being engineered in such a way that encourages compulsive use. The firms deny the allegations and say their platforms include safeguards to protect young users. The Office for National Statistics will publish the latest inflation figures in just under an hour's time. The rate of inflation, as measured by the Consumer Prices Index, rose to 3.4% in the 12 months to December, above the Bank of England's target of 2%. One of the country's leading psychiatrists has warned that there's a silent mental health pandemic in England, which is affecting patients, society and the economy. The president of the Royal College of Psychiatrists, Dr. Ladda Smith, said the longer the scale of the challenge was ignored, the harder it would be to overcome. The Department of Health said it had made almost £700 million of extra investment in mental health services this year. Tom Fielden reports.
Speaking as her term as president of the Royal College of Psychiatrists comes to an end, Dr. Smith warned a growing number of people were unable to get the help they needed when they needed it, leading them to suffer from severe mental health illnesses with insufficient support and treatment. 4.1 million people, more than a million of them children and young people, sought help from mental health services in 2024-25. That's up 56% on 8 years earlier. Dr. Smith said services were overwhelmed and under-resourced, and it was atrocious that people were increasingly able to access care only when they reached crisis point.
Donald Trump's special envoy, Steve Witkoff, says talks between Ukraine and Russia, which are being held in the Swiss city of Geneva, have led to meaningful progress to try to stop the war. Ahead of a second day of negotiations, Ukraine's President Zelensky has criticised Mr. Trump's repeated insistence that his country make concessions, saying this isn't fair. Proposals to build 7 new railway stations in Wales have been approved. 6 will be in south-east Wales, with 1 in Deeside in the north-east. The work is part of a rail modernisation plan, which the UK government says will be worth up to £14 billion and support 12,000 jobs during the coming years. Opposition parties in Wales accused Labour of reheating old announcements. Pharmacies in England have warned they'll have to make cuts to services unless there's a significant increase in government funding. In a letter to the Health Secretary, the National Pharmacy Association said some chemists are at risk of imminent closure due to intolerable financial pressures. Negotiations between the NHS and the community pharmacy sector on a new contract begin soon. Our health editor Hugh Pym reports.
The National Pharmacy Association says some members are reducing opening hours and services because government funding hasn't kept up with costs. Some pharmacists report not taking a salary and digging into pension savings to stay afloat. 1,400 high street chemists in England have closed since 2017, and the association says more will follow without extra government support. The Department of Health said they were working hard to turn around a decade of underfunding and neglect, and pharmacies were central in the shift towards community-based care.
A senior official from the Trump administration has given details of what he claims was a secret underground nuclear test carried out by China in 2020. The Assistant Secretary of State, Christopher Yu, said Beijing should come clean about testing. Previously, China, which signed the Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty, has strongly rejected claims it's carried out nuclear weapons trials and accused Washington of seeking to start its own testing. Our North America correspondent Peter Bowes reports.
Christopher Yu claimed that a remote seismic station in Kazakhstan measured an explosion of magnitude 2.75, 450 miles away in western China almost 6 years ago. He said there was very little possibility that it was anything but an explosion, adding that it wasn't consistent with mining blasts or an earthquake. Mr. Yu said it was what you would expect with a nuclear explosive test. China denied setting off an underground blast after the claim was first made earlier this month.
At the Winter Olympics in northern Italy, Great Britain's men's curlers must beat the United States in their final game later and hope other results go their way to reach the semi-finals tomorrow. Bruce Mowat's world champions were beaten 9-5 by Canada in Cortina yesterday. Britain's women are also in a perilous position. They face the US and Japan later in 2 must-win matches.
Thank you. That's 6:07. Let us go to Ben Rich at the BBC Weather Centre for our first look at the weather this morning. Hello, Ben.
Hello, Justin. Thank you very much. Good morning to you. Plenty of weather around today. Quite a mixed bag, depending on where you are across the UK. A very cold start up towards the north, particularly in parts of Scotland. And then we've got some rain pushing in from the west and also from the south. And that rain in places will start to turn to snow. So let's start actually across Northern Ireland for today, because here already some outbreaks of rain are arriving. Some of that rain is going to turn quite heavy through the morning and up over high ground, particularly over the tops of the Spearings. There will be some snow mixing in with that rain and some quite brisk winds around as well. So that mix of wet and wintry weather could make for some disruptive conditions, I think, across parts of Northern Ireland as we go through the day. Now, across England and Wales, down towards the south of England, some clouds, some outbreaks of rain. That rain turning increasingly heavy and widespread as we go through into the afternoon does bring with it the risk of flooding. We may eventually see some rain getting into parts of eastern England as well. For Wales and the Midlands, outbreaks of rain spreading northwards through the day. And here we could see some rain turning to snow over high ground across parts of mid and east Wales and into the west Midlands, especially as we head through the late afternoon and into the evening. And that snow could be disruptive in places. Northern England, not too bad today. Some bright spells around, a fair bit of cloud, but maybe some rain and hill snow much later. And then for Scotland, some sunny spells up towards the northeast, just a few wintry showers, a bit of rain into the far west of Scotland, and temperatures across the UK around 4 to 10 degrees.
Thanks very much, Ben. It's 6:08. Let's have our first look at the morning papers and the stories making headlines across the websites. According to the Daily Telegraph, the Chancellor is resisting pressure from military chiefs to spend billions more on defence. The paper says Rachel Reeves has rejected requests from the Ministry of Defence for a budget increase amid fears of a £28 billion funding shortfall, and that talks have hit a roadblock. A Treasury spokesman tells the paper that the Chancellor has been clear about her unwavering commitment to national security.
The Times reports that the government is considering ditching Labour's manifesto pledge to pay young people the same national minimum wage as older workers after suggestions that the policy is fueling youth unemployment. The paper says business leaders have told ministers a generation of young people are being priced out of the workplace because it's too expensive to hire them. It quotes a government source as saying the latest unemployment figures have strengthened the case for a rethink. We're going to be discussing this at 10 to 8. The Work and Pensions Secretary, according to The Times, says the government had a £1.5 billion drive to tackle youth unemployment, and this was a key priority.
The Guardian says new data from the insurer Aviva shows 1 in 9 new homes in England built between 2022 and 2024 are in areas which could now be at risk of flooding. That's an increase from the figure between 2013 and 2022 when it was 1 in 13 homes, now 1 in 9. The government says the analysis does not factor in flood defences which are already in place.
The Times reports data from the Health Foundation, which is a think tank, showing that 79% of private prescriptions for weight loss jabs are for women. The paper says middle-class women in their 30s and 40s make up the bulk of those taking medications like Mounjaro and Wegovy, with more than 2 million people in total using them in the UK. The Times suggests there's also a stark class divide, with people living in wealthy areas much more likely to use weight loss drugs because of the monthly cost.
We'll get into those data numbers shortly. And a few of the papers carrying striking photos of the TV chef Dame Prue Leith, who's 86 today. She celebrated last night by modelling an orange striped suit at London Fashion Week for the eco-design duo Vin and Omi. Her hair was styled in what the Mail described as a sculptural crown, threaded with branches and blooms. It's quite striking. The headline, the work of art, Prue Leith.
11 minutes past six.
Negotiators from Ukraine and Russia concluded the first 2 days of US mediated peace talks in Geneva at the end of yesterday, with the US President Donald Trump pressing Kyiv to act fast to reach a deal to end the 4-year conflict. James Waterhouse is Europe correspondent currently in Geneva. James, is that the right emphasis, and are these talks showing any signs of progress?
Oh, Emma, I'm just trying to decipher or penetrate the very beige broad statements coming from certainly the Ukrainian side this morning, saying, look, the negotiations are continuing so we can work out synchronized approaches and further steps. In short, I think we're getting one big no comment at the moment. There are sources on the Russian side claiming that that things did get tense yesterday. I think it would have been more surprising if things went swimmingly. There's a report from Axios suggesting that the Russian position remains unmoved over the question of Ukraine having to turn over territory. So we waited in this hotel conference center yesterday. You could read that by the fact that the talks are continuing into this morning, that they are still seen as constructive. That is what Steve Witkoff, Trump's special envoy, is claiming, and it is a reflection of the Trump administration's foreign policy. I mean, yesterday we had Iranian protesters, anti-regime protesters, when the US delegation were dealing with their Iranian counterparts, and then by the afternoon they'd switched to Ukraine. There were Ukrainian flags waving outside with people calling for the end to the bloodshed. And so where does a breakthrough come from? You know, if Moscow's position isn't moving, President Zelensky is reiterating the fact that he can't budge on handing over territory. He says his people won't allow it. And I think another interesting dimension, Emma, is that we saw a whole host of European security advisers, not least Jonathan Powell from the UK, also very much in the room or in the lobby yesterday. And it seems from sources in and outside of government that he is taking a lead really on trying to work on Steve Witkoff, a non-traditional diplomat, to try and keep America engaged.
Well, thanks for trying to decipher it. We'll keep getting as close as we can to the progress or lack thereof. James Waterhouse there, our Europe correspondent in Geneva.
13 minutes past six. The boss of the UK's largest commercial property company says he's more confident about shopping centres than about any other part of his business. Will has more on that in Salford. Morning, Will.
Morning, Justin. Yes, we've been speaking to Mark Allen, the chief executive of Landsec, listed on the FTSE 100, owns a portfolio worth around £11 billion, includes the likes of some of those shopping centres you mentioned, Liverpool One and St David's Centre in Cardiff, as well as major offices in central London and Greater Manchester. Last year, Landsec announced plans to move some of its investment focus, though, away from offices and into residential property. So that's where we started with Mark Allen, who told us if the government wanted more affordable homes to be built, it would need to figure out how to boost overall housing supply.
For the last 40, 50 years plus in the UK, the way we've been delivering affordable housing is by effectively attaching it to private residential development and saying a certain proportion of a development needs to be affordable, and then it's a variety of different types of affordable within that percentage. So as soon as private residential development becomes challenging, you get an automatic sort of downward pressure on affordable housing delivery. If we're going to stick with that mechanism to deliver affordable, we need to first and foremost say, how are we going to build more homes? And then, ergo, we should see more affordable housing over time. If we always try and fix the affordable housing first, we're just going to be dealing with a larger percentage of a very small number.
Because the other side of the argument, the other side of the concerns is, isn't it, that if it's all just driven by the private side of it, that drives up the rents all around that area too.
We've got to think really carefully and deeply about the affordability of our rents. We've got to understand it, what proportion of someone's disposable income is going to be comfortable paying on rent. There's no point us saying, oh, we can rent this out at a really high level.
Yeah.
Yeah, we've ultimately got to be comfortable that the demand is going to be deep and strong at the price points that we deliver, and that can grow.
I just wonder if we're trying to have too many things at the same time, that we can't have both, right? That we can't have lots of new housing, but also loads of it kind of protected and ring-fenced for certain people.
I think fundamentally we've got to prioritise, do we want to deliver more housing and economic growth, or do we want to deliver more affordable housing? I don't think you can deliver both of those at the same time. We've got to decide which one are we going to prioritise and which one will ultimately be a beneficiary of that.
Offices. Still the biggest part of your business by some distance.
Yes, it is, yeah.
What's the picture? What's the landscape broadly before we get into it at the moment?
The landscape ultimately is that different businesses and different parts of different businesses are figuring out what works best for them.
Still.
But fundamentally, I think still working that out, but it's not a one-size-fits-all approach. We've definitely seen examples of employers being more strict about things on work from home, others that I think continue to be more flexible within that. But I suppose what's most important to us is how is it translating into the utilisation and demand for our office space. So as you say, it's still the biggest part of our business. It's about 60% of our business by value. It's about 50% of the rent that we collect is coming from offices in the main in central London. We are over 99% occupied across a 5 million square foot portfolio. So we're essentially full. Now, people are using that space quite differently to how they might have used it a decade ago, but we are essentially completely full. We've got a couple of new developments that we'll be completing over the course of the next 6 months. And so we're leasing up brand new space, again, in the centre of London, and the indications of demand are similarly strong for that. But I think it is focused on a certain type of office. I don't think you could just assume this is the case across the rest of London or indeed across the country. If you're really well connected in terms of transport, if you've got lots of amenity stuff to do in and around the building, if you've got a flexible, adaptable office space, and if you've got the right sustainability credentials, energy performance, energy efficiency, that's where all of the demand is concentrated, and there just isn't enough of that space.
What about AI is the challenge to that? Lots of those companies, the type of companies you're talking about and the type of parts of the City of London, for example, are the ones that are right on the forefront of this, what looks like a kind of revolution in who does what work between AI and human being. How much have you had to factor that in?
Certainly something we think about a lot. Right now, we've just, about 3 or 4 months ago, finished a new, quite small office development, one of our flexible office offers up near King's Cross. That's leasing up pretty rapidly at the moment. a significant proportion of the people that are taking space there. So these are smaller office suites in sort of flexible, high-end type office space. A lot of those businesses taking space are AI businesses, drawn to the fact of a sort of tech-type ecosystem in and around that part of King's Cross. So there's a new part of demand coming through. We then spend a lot of time talking to our major customers. So we have a lot of law firms, a lot of professional services firms, and of course they're grappling with, well, what's going to happen to my workforce? The sense we get from that, and no one's got the correct answer, of course, on this, the sense we get from that is the nature of roles and the nature of jobs going forward is going to change. In 10 years' time, there'll be a huge number of jobs that probably don't even exist today that are created as a result of this. What I don't see any evidence of is people saying, oh, this is suddenly transforming, we need a lot less space. Right. If I look to all of the law firms at the moment who are currently looking for office space, either to replace or extend what they currently have over the next 5 years, there's probably 1.5 to 2 million square feet. That's a lot of, sorry, a bit of an abstract number that means lots to people in the property world and a lot less to other people. That's a lot of office space. And they'll be signing leases that will be probably 15-year leases. So they're confident in their requirement for that space on at least a 15 to 20-year view from where we sit.
Well, let's come back to your bread and butter again then. Retail. You earn, I'm going to rattle a few off here for people around the country. St David's in Cardiff, Bluewater, Kent, Trinity, Leeds, Liverpool One, even sort of smaller developments, right, in Gloucester and places like that as well. Are we seeing a resurgence of the kind of shopping centre?
What we're seeing in the retail space is we had a huge amount of change that I think everyone will be very aware of in terms of the emergence of online. And that's had a deep and profound long-standing impact on the amount of retail space that we need in the UK. Consumers have responded to that. Retailers have responded. And what we see now is both consumers and retailers focusing their investment and their spend on fewer, bigger, better locations. So if you have a truly dominant destination shopping centre, that's where people will gravitate towards to spend their money. That's where retailers look to invest in their stores. So we've got so many examples in our portfolio of retailers doubling or trebling the size of their stores. You look at some of the most successful retailers in the UK, they're reducing their number of stores, but they're not reducing the retail footprint they have. What they're focusing on is fewer, bigger, better stores in these great locations. There's a consumer data business called CACI, and they track where people in the UK, consumers, spend their money. And they use payment provider data to get that. And there are 6,000 individual locations they track. The top 60 of those, 1% of those locations, a third of the UK population spends money during the year in that top 1%. It's extraordinary just how focused that is. Now, that's not going to be where they're going all the time, but at some point in the year, a third of the UK population spends money in these top 60 locations. That's where our portfolio exists. No one is building any more shopping centres. You know, we bought Liverpool One, which is a fabulous centre. It is the heart of Liverpool in many ways. We bought that for round numbers, £500 million just over a year ago. If you wanted to build it today, it would cost you probably three times that. Huh. So no one's building any new ones. So in terms of us having to think about where's competition, we don't need to worry about someone building a new shopping centre next door that's going to take retailers away. So I think there's a really long-term trend now of those best destination centres, if you can invest in them and keep them appealing and evolving and changing over time, you're going to see shoppers continue to go there, retailers continue to invest. So it's the sort of business speaky, really, but it's our highest conviction sector by quite a long way at the moment.
Interesting. Mark Allen, Chief Executive of Landsec, thanks so much for your time.
Great, thank you.
And much more from Mark Allen in the latest episode of our Big Boss Interview podcast. It's up on Sounds and all the podcast platforms right now. Let's turn to the financial markets then. Rachel Winter with us this morning. Rachel's the partner and investment manager at Killick & Co. Morning, Rachel.
Morning, Will.
More Warner Brothers, Discovery, Paramount, Netflix news this morning. This time, certainly someone has told the FT in this language, put up or shut up when it comes to Paramount's approaches to buying Warner Brothers.
Yeah, so this has been dragging on since last September. It's been a very big news story for quite some time now. So it is good to see that someone has given a deadline of 7 days. We'll have to see if that is stuck to. But the thought of this ending fairly soon is quite appealing, particularly for Netflix investors, given that the shares have come down 38% in the last 6 months.
Yeah, what's your sense about why the unease from the Netflix shareholders' perspective?
It's just a very big acquisition. So Netflix at the moment is worth about $325 billion. This deal is worth $82 billion. So it's very big in comparison to the total size of Netflix.
And from the Paramount side, this is looking to buy all of the company, isn't it? Whereas Netflix wouldn't bother buying the sort of TV bit of Warner Brothers Discovery, the kind of a conventional TV arm of the business.
Exactly. So Netflix just wants to buy the movie and streaming business, and then the rest of the business, the old cable business, would be spun off separately. So the Warner investors would still own a stake in that.
As you say, this has dragged on for months already. And yet we aren't even really at the difficult bit, are we yet? Which is what regulators, not just in the United States, but regulators here might make of this deal too.
Exactly. And that process can take months, if not years. So despite this 7-day deadline, we're very far from the end.
Sounds like it's something we're going to talk about again, even beyond, as you say, that 7-day deadline. Let's look ahead to a little bit later on this morning as well, Rachel, because the inflation data out at 7 o'clock from the ONS. It's obviously going to be increasingly watched this morning, given what went on in the jobs market yesterday. Just round up from an investment perspective, your takeaway.
Yeah, so yesterday we had some weak labour market data. Unemployment had gone up to 5.2%. That was the highest in 5 years. Ideally, we would like some weaker inflation data to be released this morning, and that will allow the Bank of England to reduce interest rates next month, and that hopefully would be good for economic growth.
And given the data that we had, and we chatted about it on the programme yesterday at 7 and 8 o'clock in terms of the employment picture, do you think, again, from an investment perspective, does that increase the likelihood of an interest rate cut from the Bank of England, given what we're seeing going on in the jobs market?
It does. So having unemployment at the highest it's been in 5 years, and also the youth unemployment was the highest it's been in a decade, that really suggests the economy does need a bit more help. And at the moment, it's suggested that there is an 80% chance of the Bank of England cutting rates when they meet in March.
Rachel, thanks so much for your time this morning. Rachel Winter there, partner and investment manager at Killick & Co. And a bit of news also on the front page of the FT, Justin and Emma as well. Christine Lagarde, the head of the European Central Bank, now expected to leave her 8-year term early. Sounds like it's before the French presidential election, so that France can have a chance to suggest who will be her successor in that big job.
Well, thank you for that. 26 minutes past six. Let us turn to Cathy in the sport.
Morning. Thank you very much. Real Madrid's Champions League playoff tie at Benfica was halted for 10 minutes last night after Vinicius Jr. reported alleged racist abuse. He and his teammates left the field after the referee made the gesture that signals racist abuse following a conversation with Vinicius. The Brazilian forward had just put the Spanish visitors 1-0 ahead in the game, and that was the final score. After the match, Trent Alexander-Arnold condemned the abuse in his post-match interview, saying, "I think what has happened tonight is a disgrace to football and overshadowed the performance as well as an amazing goal." In the night's other games, holders PSG beat Monaco 3-2 and both Galatasaray and Dortmund won tonight. Newcastle United aiming for the last 16 of the Champions League. They face Azerbaijan's side Karabag in a first leg playoff tie, and Arsenal women host OHL in the Champions League knockout round playoffs. And despite being down to 10 men, Dundee United booked their place in the quarterfinals of the Scottish Cup with a 2-1 win over fourth tier Spartans. At the Winter Olympics, Team GB's curling medal hopes are now in jeopardy after a 9-5 defeat to Canada. Bruce Moat's team have lost 4 of their 8 matches in the round-robin stage and must beat the USA today, plus hope other results go their way if they are to reach the semi-finals.
We've been around the block a wee bit. We know what it's like to try and bounce back in games after big mistakes, so there's nothing new there. It's just obviously disappointing to make those mistakes in a stage like this where, you know, you've been working for it for quite a while.
6 Russian and 4 Belarusian athletes will compete under their nation's flags at the upcoming Winter Paralympics. In September, the International Paralympic Committee lifted its ban on athletes from the two countries competing at the Games. It will mark the first time a Russian flag has been flown at a Paralympic Games since the Sochi 2014 Games. Henry Pollock has been handed his first test start, with England's rugby union head coach Steve Borthwick making 3 changes to his starting 15 for England's Six Nations match against Ireland on Saturday.
He's just an incredible character. We talk about his excitement, the supporters see the joy he plays the game with. I think they are excited by him, amongst other players in our team, because we've got lots of talented players in our team.
While Scotland have withdrawn the injured trio of Jamie Ritchie, Jack Dempsey and Jamie Doby for their game against Wales at the weekend. And in tennis, Carlos Alcaraz has won his first match since becoming the youngest man to complete the career Grand Slam at the Australian Open. The world number one beat Arthur Rinderknecht of France in straight sets in the first round at the Qatar Open in Doha.
Carthy, thanks very much.
Hello, I'm Jill Scott.
And I'm Joe Marler.
And this is the sound of me rubbing Joe in sticky tape.
Because for Red Nose Day, we're taking ourselves a little less seriously to help do some serious good for comic relief.
And what better way than covering Joe's legs in tape and seeing how fast he can run?
I am starting to have second thoughts about this, mate. How's all this coming off?
It'll be fine. Just give it a go. Head online and get your fundraising pack to see how you can help.
You best be laughing, Britain.
Take yourself funny for money. Just search Red Nose Day.
Time's just coming up to 6:30. You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Emma Barnett, Justin Webb and Caroline Nichols with the news.
The National Crime Agency has warned the threat to children from online sexual abuse is getting worse, with a number of arrests rising sharply to 1,000 every month. The agency is urging tech companies to step up efforts to tackle the abuse, warning that many images are being found on social media and mainstream platforms. Officials fear abusive behaviour is being normalised online. One of the country's leading psychiatrists has warned that there's a silent mental health pandemic in England, which is affecting patients, society and the economy. The president of the Royal College of Psychiatrists, Dr. Ladder Smith, said the longer the scale of the challenge was ignored, the harder it would be to overcome. The Department of Health said it had made almost £700 million of extra investment in mental health services this year. Donald Trump's special envoy, Steve Witkoff, says talks between Ukraine and Russia, which are being held in the Swiss city of Geneva, have led to meaningful progress to try to stop the war. Ahead of a second day of negotiations, Ukraine's President Zelensky has criticised Mr. Trump's repeated insistence that his country make concessions, saying this isn't fair. Proposals to build 7 new railway stations in Wales have been approved. 6 will be in south-east Wales, with 1 in Deeside in the north-east. The work is part of a rail modernisation plan, which the UK government says will be worth up to £14 billion and support 12,000 jobs during the coming years. Opposition parties in Wales accused Labour of reheating old announcements. Some of the UK's biggest online streamers have told the BBC they're concerned about plans for new age checks on the social media platform Discord starting next month. The online chat service is used by more than 200 million people, many of them gamers. It says it wants to create a safer experience for children, but some users are worried about handing over their data.
Caroline, thank you. It's 29 minutes to 7. One of the country's leading psychiatrists has issued this stark warning about the threat posed by what she describes as a silent mental health pandemic affecting patients, society and the economy, urging for rapid change to stop care from only becoming available when people reach crisis point. We'll talk to her just after 8 o'clock. But first, let's talk to Tom Fielden, Today programme correspondent. What has been said? I've alluded to it there, and a little bit more detail would be great, Tom.
Well, this is Dr. Ladder Smith, whose term as president of the Royal College of Psychiatrists is just coming to an end. And I think it's safe to say she's decided to go out with a bit of a bang rather than a whimper, saying we've fallen way behind with the provision of mental health services. And that's resulted in this silent pandemic being driven really by austerity, recession, social media use, and of course, the COVID pandemic. And that's ended up with this growing number of people unable to get the help they need when they need it.
And I suppose it's also about taking that seriously, because there will be those who have often seen this, like we were talking a little bit about on the programme yesterday, through the prism of the economy and the impact on the economy. But actually, there are some specific factors, like you've just outlined, as you've just outlined, that would mean this is more serious than some people would think, and affecting more people.
Absolutely, yes. I mean, I think 4.1 million people sought help from mental health services in 24-25. That's the last year we have figures for. It's a 56% increase on the 2.6 million people who got in contact with mental health services in 2016-17. And of course, that figure includes more than a million children and young people. Now, the Department of Health says it is taking this very seriously. It's invested an additional £700 million in mental health services this year alone, hiring almost 8,000 extra mental health workers. And they do also have another launch this morning, an initiative on talking therapies aimed at trying to get people back to work. But the point Dr. Laddie Smith is making is really that mental illnesses are accounting for 20% of the disease burden in England and really should be getting 20% of the NHS budget. But as things stand, they're just getting 9% of that budget. And the point is, it really is important to get in early, if you like. There are cost-effective treatments available for even the most severe mental health conditions. Dr. Smith is saying services are just overwhelmed, under-resourced, and she called it atrocious that people were increasingly only able to get the care they needed when they really reached crisis point and were turning up in A&E.
Well, a point, and many of those points, we will pick up with her just after 8 o'clock. Tom Fielden, thank you.
Time now, 26 minutes to seven. The Times is reporting this morning that the government's latest U-turn could be on its manifesto commitment to bring the youth minimum wage into line with older workers. Let's talk to Joe Pike, our political correspondent. What was the commitment, Joe? Remind us of what it was and what are they thinking of changing?
Justin, the situation at the moment is that if you are 18, 19 or 20, the minimum wage is a tenner an hour. Once you reach 21, it jumps to 12.21 per hour. But Labour had pledged to change that, and words like harmonisation or equalisation are often used. On page 45 of the Labour manifesto, if you've got your copy to hand, the party pledged to remove the discriminatory age ban so all adults are entitled to the same minimum wage, delivering a pay rise to hundreds of thousands of workers across the UK. Interestingly, on the same page, there's a wider commitment to stop the chaos, turn the page and kickstart economic growth. Now, one government source has told me this morning that a change in policy is speculation at this point, but somebody else in government has confirmed that ministers are interested in slowing down the rise in the wages for 18, 19 and 20-year-olds. We know it's being talked about in government, therefore. We also know that Alan Milburn, the Blair-era health secretary, who's leading the review into youth unemployment, is looking at all of this. But my sense, Justin, is that it's unlikely ministers would scrap the commitment entirely from the manifesto. More possible they delay that equalisation to a later date.
And the reason they delay it is because of youth unemployment.
Absolutely. The stats out yesterday and in previous years have changed the equation, helping those who want a shift in government policy. As of yesterday, youth unemployment was at 16.1% towards the end of last year, the highest level since 2014. The Resolution Foundation pointing out it is higher than the EU average for the first time since records began at the turn of the millennium. Now, people within government say this has been rising for 4 years, and what is the minimum wage for young people isn't the only driver. And they say they're doing a lot to try and sort this out and have put £1.5 billion into it. But there are clearly groups, including business groups, who want a shift. Those in the hospitality industry that employ a lot of young people in entry-level jobs are arguing they want to give opportunities, but it is increasingly expensive. On the other side of the equation, trade unions, though, Justin, already arguing against any watering down of that Labour manifesto commitment. But as I say, do not expect a full U-turn at this stage. It's possible there will be a shift. It seems to be being discussed, but it's more likely, I think, to be tinkering to ensure that if the change does come into place, it will be far further down the track.
OK, and we will hear from both sides of that equation, from the National Secretary of the GMB Union, but also from Luke Johnson, the entrepreneur, at 10 to 8.
It's 23 minutes to 7.
Essex police say they're assessing information about private flights in and out of Stansted Airport following the publication of the Epstein files. Let's talk to Nick Johnson, our correspondent, who is on the line. What more do we know, Nick, about the extent of this? It's not a full investigation yet. They're just looking at it. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. And it's that language around what they're doing is extremely important, these police forces. They say that they are assessing information released in the Epstein files. So they are taking a look at whether an investigation should be launched. So they're not in the stages of an investigation just yet. But what we've heard from Essex Police, it follows a letter which the former Prime Minister, Gordon Brown, wrote to police forces suggesting that they should be re-examining whether Jeffrey Epstein's victims were trafficked through Stansted Airport. Now, Stansted has two terminals. It has its main passenger terminal, but it also has a private jet terminal. They operate completely independently of one another. The airport says that there's no suggestion that, private passengers can get into the main airport. But yeah, Essex Police joins Thames Valley Police and Surrey Police, who are say they're assessing allegations relating to the former Prince Andrew. He, of course, has always denied any wrongdoing. But the National Police Chiefs Council, so they bring police leaders together around the country, sort of sound like they're coordinating things now. They've created a new group to support these police forces around the country, which are in these early stages of assessing these claims.
And just the link with Andrew Mountbatten Windsor is what? Because Thames Valley Police have been assessing their own allegations, and there were allegations also made that a woman was sent to the UK by Epstein for the purpose of a sexual encounter with Andrew Mountbatten Windsor. Now, as you say, he denies doing anything wrong at any stage. But does this investigation by the Essex Police involve him, I suppose, is the question?
Not as far as we know. Our understanding at this stage is this Essex Police assessment purely relates to the suggestion that Jeffrey Epstein may have used the private jet terminal at Stansted Airport to traffic victims through the UK in relation to police forces looking at claims surrounding Andrew Mountbatten Windsor. We know that Thames Valley, as you've already mentioned, is looking at two allegations, one of which you've mentioned, the other allegation relating to his time as UK trade envoy. Surrey Police, we understand, is also the other force assessing these claims into the former Prince Andrew. As I say again, he's always denied any wrongdoing. And just to reiterate, these are assessments at this stage. Police were still looking at whether an investigation should be formally launched.
Nick Johnson, thank you.
It's 20 to 7. Here he comes, the 41-year-old who changed millions of people's lives, set to take the stand in front of jurors. I'm talking about Mark Zuckerberg, the chief executive of Meta, which owns Facebook, Instagram and WhatsApp, who is set to testify in this groundbreaking social media trial that's ongoing. Earlier, I spoke to Peter Bowes, the BBC's North America correspondent, who began by telling me about the most anticipated witness in the case.
Mark Zuckerberg is hugely anticipated. This is the first of thousands of similar cases accusing social media companies of engineering their apps to be addictive. A woman identified only as KGM or Kaylee in court, her identity protected because the alleged damage to her happened when she was a child. She, along with her mother, have sued Instagram, owned by Meta, also Google's YouTube, because they say the platforms knowingly include features like endless scrolling, autoplay, algorithm-driven recommendations that make the apps addictive and, she says, exposed her to harmful content. She claims to have suffered symptoms that include anxiety, mental health issues, body dysmorphia, and thoughts of suicide. And she says that she started using social media at the age of 6 and that by the time she was 16, on one occasion, she used Instagram for 16 hours in a single day, allegedly becoming compulsively addicted to the app. And so these points are going to be put to Mark Zuckerberg. His company, Meta, have said in the past that it strongly disagrees with the allegations and has said that the evidence during this trial will show that the company has a long-standing commitment to supporting young people.
In terms of what we expect him to say or how this may go down, I mean, Instagram chief, part of the same company, Adam Mosseri, he was the first Silicon Valley executive to testify on February the 11th. This trial is continuing for some time, as trials often do, but any sense of how bullish Zuckerberg will be?
Well, it's going to be interesting to see, because this is the first time that he has been called to defend the company in front of a jury. You may remember a couple of years ago, he appeared before a congressional committee when, prompted by a senator, he actually turned around and addressed some of the families and essentially apologised for what they're going through. But this is a different situation because the consequences, potential consequences, if the jury agrees with the plaintiff in this case, could be thousands and thousands of dollars that certainly Instagram, or at least its parent company, Meta, maybe YouTube, have to pay, punitive damages and potentially long-term implications for the way that they operate.
Peter Bowes, our North America's correspondent. Thank you.
And that brings us to 17 minutes to 7 and to look at some of the front pages of the papers. The Sun, really interesting, really going for it when it comes to its relationship with Andrew Mountbatten Windsor. So the front page says cops in Andy Sachs probe, Andrew Mountbatten Windsor last night facing a criminal probe, they claim, into sex trafficking claims. At least seven police forces examining new evidence from the Jeffrey Epstein files. But the interesting thing is perhaps an inside page, which is written by Dominic Mohan, who's a former editor of the Times, their guest columnist, in which he calls Andrew a number of names. I won't repeat them, actually, but basically what they're doing is challenging Andrew to sue. So he says in his column, Andrew has denied any wrongdoing, is welcome to sue, bring it on, be my guest. The address is on the back of the newspaper. See you in the Royal Courts of Justice. And Dominic Mohan also says, I've been around the royals long enough during my career to witness the obsequious deference and puking reverence that engulfs them, that cringeworthy regal subservience which breeds a literal sense of entitlement, arrogance and haughtiness where no one dares challenge or speak out. And that, he claims, is where the perilous danger to this monarchy lies now.
And just sticking with Andrew Mountbatten Windsor, formerly Prince Andrew, the Times has a story that he could be hauled in front of MPs over allegations he shared confidential reports during his time in that role as trade envoy. Liam Byrne, the chairman of the Commons Business and Trade Committee, said that nothing is off the table and MPs are not in the market for letting anything slips through the cracks. And just talking as well around a story we mentioned a bit earlier in terms of what's going on with the police and some of the statistics around sex abuse in the UK, specifically child sex abuse, police have said is soaring with 1,000 paedophile suspects being arrested each month. This is one of the leads in The Guardian this morning. The number of children being rescued from harm, though, rising by 50% in the last 5 years. These figures are coming from the National Crime Agency, which says the growth in offending was driven by technology and linked to the radicalisation of offenders in online forums, encouraging people to view images of child sex abuse by reassuring them that it's normal.
Amazing story on the front page of the Financial Times. Passports and other identity documents belonging to hundreds of attendees at Abu Dhabi's flagship investment conference have been exposed online, compromising the security of high-profile individuals from international finance, politics and crypto, the FT says. So these are scans of more than 700 passports and state identity cards. They've been discovered on an unprotected cloud storage server associated with the Abu Dhabi Finance Week, which is a state-sponsored event, hosts more than 35,000 attendees. It took place back in December. Among the identity documents exposed, the FT says, were David Cameron, former Prime Minister, Alan Howard as well, hedge fund manager, and Anthony Scaramucci, the US investor, podcaster and former White House communications director. All of these according to documents reviewed by the FT. And the paper says as well that it was all publicly accessible to everyone using a web browser.
And just very, very quickly, a story again to point your attention to in The Guardian. Live Like Monks, a monastery in Italy, has urged its monks to avoid social media and streaming platforms. But my favourite part of this is that Father Matteo Ferrari, the prior of this monastery, chose to publish this long letter about diversion and addiction. And it's just interesting, in light of that case in America about social media addiction, he chose to publish that letter on Facebook.
Time 13 minutes to 7. The government is announcing how extra money for rail infrastructure in Wales is going to be spent. The money was allocated in Rachel Reeves's budget, but today we're going to get details of the new stations to be built. Jo Stevens, the Welsh Secretary, is on the line. Morning to you.
Good morning, Justin.
Are we learning anything today that we didn't already know?
Oh, absolutely. So today we are announcing a generational commitment to transform Welsh Rail. This is a pipeline of projects to be delivered as quickly as possible in partnership with the Welsh Government, making up for the years of underinvestment by previous governments that we've had in Wales. And it builds on the nearly £500 million that we announced in the spending review last year. This will be seven stations, changes to infrastructure, over 40 projects that are listed in a vision document that has been agreed with Welsh Government and Transport for Wales, that will connect people to the jobs we're creating in every part of the country, so North and South, Mid Wales and West Wales. And this is through partnership working that has been my priority from day one in government to make sure that we can really change that historic underinvestment and turn this around.
When you mentioned the words vision document, I think people will wonder, well, hang on a second, we could all have visions. What about the actual money for actual schemes? The suggestion is that the total amount that could be spent is up to 14 billion. Isn't it? That is the estimate from Transport for Wales.
That's the current estimate.
Yeah, but that money has not been committed.
Entire programme. Well, obviously, we've committed for this spending review. Rail infrastructure investment is done in spending review periods. We've committed for last year's spending review through to 2027.
And does that pay for, sorry to interrupt, does the existing commitment pay for the seven new stations? That's definitely going to happen.
No, there are additional stations as a result of the announcement today. So,
is the money alongside that announcement, I suppose, is my question. If you're listening in Wales at the moment, you are definitely going to get these stations. They are going to be built. The money is there.
Absolutely. We have committed today to deliver this pipeline of projects in the Transport for Wales document that includes seven new stations and all the other infrastructure upgrades on lines right across Wales. So in future spending reviews, the money will be announced and allocated. But this is a commitment to deliver what's in this document, a pipeline of projects, and to deliver it as quickly as possible.
What Plaid Cymru say is just devolve all the powers to do these things to Wales. Let Welsh people be in charge of Welsh transport budgets and the Welsh rail budget. Why not?
Well, we could, you know, not decide to spend any of this money or commit any of this money and spend the next few years in a constitutional seminar about devolution of a very fragmented rail system that involves cross-border rail, so that you could have devolution of heavy rail to Wales. But what we as a government and the Welsh Labour government have agreed to do today is deliver the pipeline of projects that passengers and businesses need and want in Wales, so that they can get to the jobs that we are creating in every corner of Wales, and making sure that people have a decent public transport system that's fit for the future. That's what my priority is. That's what the First Minister's priority is, and also the Transport Minister in Wales, Ken Skates.
And just on a further question on the subject of rail and the detail of what's happening, one of the things that people have been crying out for, particularly businesses, haven't they, is the electrification of the North Wales main line. That is not in these plans, is that right?
Electrification of the North Wales main line and a continuation of the currently electrified up to part of the main line in South Wales is part of these plans. So the people making those criticisms need to read the document properly, and they will see exactly what is in it, which includes electrification.
So it is going to happen?
It's in the document. We've committed to this pipeline of work. And
Is that the same as saying it is going to happen?
Well, I can't be any more explicit than saying that we are going to deliver this pipeline of projects as soon as possible, and it will be done through the spending reviews. The next spending review in 2027 for 2028 onwards.
Do you believe then that, for instance, on the North Wales line, the electrification of it, that work will start during this parliament?
Well, certainly there will be work starting during this parliament on a number of things in the document, which include the stations in South Wales and also the development work for the new station in South Wales in Deeside, which will be the first new station in North Wales in a generation. Rail infrastructure funding and work is quite complex, as you know, so there is development work and then there is delivery work, but all the work will be starting from this pipeline of projects. We are committed to delivering this as quickly as possible.
Okay.
It's not like, you know, that scene from Wallace and Gromit where you can just keep putting rail tracks down as the train is going around the track. It all has to be done, planned and delivered while you keep the railway operational.
It was a good scene, wasn't it? Just a final thought with your wider cabinet responsibilities hat on. Labour's manifesto 2024. Labour will also remove the discriminatory age ban, so all adults are entitled to the same minimum wage, delivering a pay rise to hundreds of thousands of workers across the UK. The Times suggesting this morning that commitment might go. Is it still a commitment that younger people receive the same minimum wage during the course of this parliament than older ones?
There's an unsourced, anonymous briefing or whatever in the Times this morning. That is not government policy.
Right. So government policy is still...
Government policy is, as we have stated in our manifesto. And, you know, we've had many naysayers over the years about the national minimum wage. People said in 1998 that it caused mass unemployment and it didn't. And every time there is a rise in the national minimum wage, people complain about it. The fact is, people shouldn't be on poverty wages. This is a minimum wage, not a maximum wage. And it's quite right that people are paid well for the job that they do.
Should you, though, be open to slowing it down if employers say, hang on a second, this is causing a real temporary problem?
I don't accept that it's causing a problem. The Low Pay Commission say that the evidence does not show that there is a direct correlation between problems and the raising of the national minimum wage. We came into work on a manifesto to make work pay, and that's exactly what we're doing.
Jo Stephens, Welsh Secretary, thank you very much for talking to us.
7 minutes to seven. It's unsurprising, but true and worth analysing. Women and the middle classes are dominating the private take-up of weight loss injections. That's according to a new analysis of private prescriptions for drugs such as Mounjaro. The research also showed people living in wealthy areas are much more likely to use weight loss injections despite obesity rates being significantly higher in poorer regions. Samantha Field is a senior fellow at the think tank, the Health Foundation, and the co-author of this research, the think tank being behind these numbers. Samantha, what does this tell us, do you think, about the inequalities within the way this, you know, this relatively new drug is essentially being dispersed, even though, you know, some of it's through the NHS and some of it's private?
Well, as you say, people in the poorest areas are using these drugs far less than people in richer areas. We can see that prescription rates are almost 30% lower in the most deprived areas. But when you factor in that obesity is almost twice as common in the poorest areas, this gap gets much bigger. So the implication is we have an almost 20-year gap in healthy life expectancy between the most and least deprived populations. And we know these medicines have very positive implications for health outcomes for those who take them. So this unequal pattern of distribution, if it persists as more people start taking them, it could have far-reaching effects on health inequalities.
And in terms of, I mean, that's the significance, I suppose. Is there anything else you wanted to raise, though, by doing this analysis?
I think the headline finding for me really is we're using them as a solution to a problem that is entirely preventable. So although the findings of this analysis are really important for policymakers as they consider how to approach the rollout of these medicines in the NHS, it also highlights the need to retain focus on preventing obesity in the first place. And this is done through population interventions that improve our food environment, things like taxation, advertising restrictions on unhealthy food, and reformulating food to make it healthier.
And I suppose, though, if that isn't happening, although there's work around that and there's definitely more noise around that, in the meantime, we have an NHS that's spending, you know, billions a year on obesity, but now looking to these jabs as a potential help. But at the same time, this sort of shadow market, this private market, not even mentioning the black market, is developing. And I suppose it's just how we'll live with that and what impact that will have.
Well, at the moment, we know that the majority of people who are taking these medicines are doing so on the private market. And the people who can access these medicines on the NHS are currently limited to the people who have the highest clinical need. I think it's difficult to say whether the best thing is to make them more freely available or to change the eligibility on the NHS. But I think it's important for the government, the NHS and policymakers to understand that this is happening because it could have implications on health inequalities if these patterns persist.
And it's also striking the number of women. It might not be surprising, but just, you know, just quite how dominant that is in the data that's been analysed of private prescriptions. Samantha Fields, senior fellow at the Health Foundation, which is a think tank, and the co-author of this research. Thank you.
I'm no longer ravenous. I'm no longer desperate. I'll no longer eat until I fall asleep and I have to rest.
The Hunger Game, a new five-part series exploring the meteoric rise of weight loss drugs.
It's been an incredible story with these drugs. The uptake, the amount of product that's been sold, the amount of money it's cost, the amount of money that's been made.
What the drugs do, how they work, and the knock-on effects of their widespread use.
People are having to completely alter the way they do business.
The Hunger Game with me, Professor Giles Yeo, from BBC Radio 4. Listen now on BBC Sounds.
Weather time. Here's Ben Rich.
Thank you very much, Justin. Good morning to you. We have some rain and, in places, some snow in the forecast today. A combination that could cause some disruption across particularly western, central and southern parts of the UK. Let's begin our forecast across the southwest of England, the southeast of England and eastern England. A mostly cloudy start to the day here. We've already got a little bit of patchy rain around, and that rain is just going to turn heavier and more persistent as we go through the day. There is the risk that we could see some flooding, particularly in places that have already been so badly affected by flooding in recent days and weeks. And then for Wales and for the Midlands, a lot of cloud around here, some mostly light and patchy rain first thing, especially across Wales, but a little bit of wintriness mixing in with that up over high ground. And as we go through the day, particularly as we get into this afternoon and this evening, as we see wet weather pushing up from the south, there is the increasing chance of some snow up over high ground, especially in mid and east Wales and into parts of the West Midlands. And actually, as we head through the evening, there could be enough snow over some of those high ground areas to give some disruption. I think at low levels, it's more likely to stay as a mix of rain, sleet and a little bit of wet snow. Now, for northern England, actually, the weather not looking too bad here through today. A lot of dry weather around, but rather cloudy conditions, a few bright or sunny spells. But some rain and hill snow may start to push up from the south as we head into this evening. Northern Ireland, not a great day here. A lot of cloud around, outbreaks of quite heavy and persistent rain developing with some snow over high ground, particularly over the tops of the Sperrins. It'll be windy here as well. For Scotland, the north and the east of Scotland seeing some spells of sunshine and just one or two wintry showers. For western and southwestern parts of Scotland, some cloud and a little bit of rain later on. It will be quite windy and temperatures across the UK around 4 to 10 degrees.
Ben, thank you very much. You are listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Justin Webb and Emma Barnett. It's 7 o'clock on Wednesday, the 18th of February. Good morning if you're just joining us. The headlines. The National Crime Agency says around 1,000 arrests linked to online child sex abuse are taking place every month, and it's urged tech firms to do more to tackle the problem. A leading psychiatrist has warned that there is a silent mental health pandemic in England, with overstretched services unable to cope. We'll be talking to her just after 8 o'clock.
And also in this hour, Ken Follett shares with us the book that inspired his enthusiasm for reading.
I remember asking my father what a martini was, and he said, I think it's some kind of drink. He actually had no idea. And the cigarettes and the fast cars, all of this was just a magical world to a 12-year-old boy.
No prizes for guessing which spy he loved. And Skimo is having its debut at the Winter Olympics today. We hear how skiing and mountaineering combine in a new sport. The BBC News is read this morning by Caroline Nichols.
The National Crime Agency has warned the threat to children from online sexual abuse is getting worse, with the number of arrests rising sharply to 1,000 every month. The agency is urging tech companies to step up efforts to tackle the problem, warning that many images are being found on social media and mainstream platforms. Officials fear abusive behaviour is being normalised online. Our correspondent Nomia Iqbal has more details.
The National Crime Agency says these horrific crimes aren't just being carried out on the dark web, but on mainstream platforms online. It has found offenders have been commissioning live-stream sexual abuse of children, mainly young boys, on demand for as little as £20. It says algorithms push many abusers into parts of the online world where their behaviour is normalised and then escalates. The NCA says it is uncovering sadistic behaviour, which is far worse than it has seen before. It says police can't combat the problem alone, and it wants technology companies to do more. This includes making their platforms hostile for offenders and introducing safeguards to stop children from taking, sharing or viewing nude images. It also wants there to be stronger guidance and education for parents and teachers.
The rate of inflation, as measured by the Consumer Prices Index, fell to 3% in the 12 months to January, according to the latest figures which have just been published by the Office for National Statistics. That's compared with 3.4% in the previous month. One of the country's leading psychiatrists has warned that there's a silent mental health pandemic in England, which is affecting patients, society and the economy. The president of the Royal College of Psychiatrists, Dr. Ladda Smith, said the longer the scale of the challenge was ignored, the harder it would be to overcome. The Department of Health said it made almost £700 million of extra investment in mental health services this year. Tom Fielden reports.
4.1 million people, more than a million of them children and young people, sought help from mental health services in 2024 to 25, up 56% on 8 years earlier. Dr. Smith said services were overwhelmed and under-resourced, and it was atrocious that people could only access care when they were at crisis point. The government says it's invested nearly £700 million extra in mental health services this year.
Donald Trump's special envoy, Steve Witkoff, says talks between Ukraine and Russia, which are being held in the Swiss city of Geneva, have led to meaningful progress to try to stop the war. Ahead of a second day of negotiations, Ukraine's President Zelensky has criticised Mr. Trump's repeated insistence that his country make concessions, saying this isn't fair. Our international editor, Jeremy Bowen, sent this report from Ukraine's northeastern city, Kharkiv, ahead of the fourth anniversary of Russia's full-scale invasion.
In Slovyansk and Kramatorsk, heavily defended so-called fortress cities here in eastern Ukraine, the remaining residents have to deal with attacks by Russian drones and the brutal winter cold in houses that often don't have power or heating. At the US brokered talks in Geneva, Russia's price for a ceasefire still appears to be Ukraine handing over these cities and all of the Donetsk region that it still holds. I asked Brigadier General Alexander Pivnenko, who commands Ukraine's National Guard, whether that would be acceptable.
I actually believe that this is impossible at the moment. A ceasefire along the line of contact is something we can still understand, but no one will give up territories. If there is an order to withdraw, then we will withdraw. But will the population of our country accept that?
Brigadier Pivnenko said that if Ukraine had wanted to give up territory in Donetsk, it could have done so when Russia mounted the full-scale invasion almost exactly 4 years ago.
Downing Street says the Prime Minister discussed the ongoing Ukraine negotiations with Donald Trump when the two spoke on the phone last night. Number 10 also said that the two leaders confirmed their joint commitment to promoting stability and peace in the Middle East. The Trump administration says it supports the UK's controversial deal to hand over the Chagos Islands to Mauritius. Under the plan, the government will lease back the military base on Diego Garcia that's used by British and American armed forces. Last month, President Trump described the deal as an act of great stupidity, but later said he recognised it had been the best Sir Keir Starmer could make. The US State Department has announced there'll be talks next week with Mauritius to ensure long-term operation of the base. Proposals to build seven new railway stations in Wales have been approved. It's part of a rail modernisation plan which the UK government says will be worth up to £14 billion and support 12,000 jobs during the coming years. Opposition parties in Wales accused Labour of reheating old announcements. Here's our Wales correspondent, Thomas Morgan.
In last year's spending review, the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, announced £445 million worth of investment on rail projects in Wales. And now we have more detail about where that money will be spent. Six of the new stations will be in South East Wales, with one in Deeside in the North East. However, this initial improvement is part of a longer-term plan, heralded by one Welsh Government source as the biggest day in devolution, as it signifies the beginning of a £14 billion vision to improve the railways in Wales. The Prime Minister, Sir Keir Starmer, said the commitment was putting Wales on the front foot, although work on the new stations is due to begin later this year. As of yet, there's no timescale on when it'll be finished.
A senior official from the Trump administration has given details of what he claims was a secret underground nuclear test carried out by China in 2020. The Assistant Secretary of State, Christopher Yu, said Beijing should come clean about testing. Previously, China, which signed the Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty, has strongly rejected claims it's carried out nuclear weapons trials and accused Washington of seeking to start its own testing. Our North America correspondent, Peter Bowes, reports.
Christopher Yu claimed that a remote seismic station in Kazakhstan measured an explosion of magnitude 2.75, 450 miles away in western China almost 6 years ago. He said there was very little possibility that it was anything but an explosion, adding that it wasn't consistent with mining blasts or an earthquake. Mr. Yu said it was what you would expect with a nuclear explosive test. China denied setting off an underground blast after the claim was first made earlier this month. The Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty Organisation, which is charged with detecting nuclear test explosions, said there was insufficient data to confirm Mr Yu's allegation. Last October, President Trump wrote that because of what he claimed were other countries' testing programs, he'd instructed the Department of War to start testing American nuclear weapons on an equal basis. The US last tested a nuclear weapon in 1992.
At the Winter Olympics in northern Italy, there's been disappointment for Great Britain's men's curlers. The favourites find themselves on the brink of an early exit after losing to Canada yesterday. Our sports correspondent Andy Swiss reports from Cortina.
Bruce Mowat's team had gone into these games as the reigning world champions and favourites, but their hopes of a medal are now in serious jeopardy.
He has to hit this red and roll over. I think that's a steal. There'll only be one.
Their defeat to Canada was their fourth loss in their eight matches so far. Britain had briefly led just after the halfway stage, but Canada responded in impressive fashion to take victory. To reach the semi-finals, the British team will now have to beat the US in their final round-robin match later today and hope other results go their way. And Britain's women are also in a perilous position. They face the US and Japan later on in two must-win matches.
Andy Swiss reporting.
Thank you for that. 9 minutes past seven. The latest inflation figures are just out. As you heard probably in the news, consumer prices rising by 3% in the year to January, down from 3.4% the previous month. Grant Fitzner is on the line, Chief Economist and Director at the Office of National Statistics. Morning to you.
Good morning.
And this is what was expected.
In line with market expectations, slightly above the bank's forecast.
What can you tell us about the detail of what's happening behind the scenes, under the bonnet, as it were? What is still going up, broadly speaking, and what is being held back?
Well, as always, it was a combination of factors that drove the headline numbers this month. The biggest contribution came from cheaper petrol and diesel prices, but we also have seen a small fall in lower food prices, and that compares with the large increase this time last year. And then on airfares, which can be quite volatile, we saw a large increase last month and a large reversal or unwinding of that this month. So those factors were the main ones bringing the headline rate down. Now, they were partly offset by a number of other factors, including hotel stays.
What does it tell us then, or what will it tell the Bank of England's Monetary Policy Committee, do you think, and what impact do you think it'll have on their next decision about interest rates?
Well, I don't think the numbers will be a surprise to anyone out there who's been looking at the forecasts. And of course, we don't make forecasts ourselves. We just report the statistics. But I think in terms of the inflation outlook, obviously the bank, the Office of Budget Responsibility, city forecasters are expecting the headline rate to continue to fall through the rest of the year. And if you look at some of the other data we published this morning, so for example, factory gate prices, they've been coming down over the last 3 months. And of course, yesterday we published our labour market numbers and they've seen private sector wage growth continue to fall. So I guess in terms of how they may feed into headline consumer inflation, they're all positive indicators.
Okay, Grant Fitzner from the ONS, thank you for that. Let us talk to one of those city forecasters. Well, Simon French is on the line, Chief Economist at Panmure Gordon. Morning to you. Hello, Simon French, can you hear me? Oh, that is disappointing. Well, he was there. He doesn't seem to be there.
But he's not anymore.
Not anymore. No, no. We can't find it. We're going to come back to Simon French. We do need to hear what he says specifically about the wider picture as well and whether that does mean that interest rates are about to come down. We will have that for you, but not yet.
We will, but at 11 minutes past seven, talking of technology or failure of, a major artificial intelligence summit is happening in Delhi at the moment. It's being billed as the first big international AI meeting hosted in the global south. Again, technology, after a chaotic start, there was long queues, confusion, overcrowding, people not being able to make the tech in their booths work on its opening day. The focus returns to what the so-called tech bros have to say on making AI safe and beneficial, we hope. Professor Joshua Bengio is one of the world's leading artificial intelligence researchers. He was on the programme yesterday and he told us that we don't fully understand the risk artificial intelligence poses.
We are seeing these systems reason about how to preserve themselves We're seeing these systems willing to be deceptive, even to blackmail an engineer so that they would not be shut down. And of course, we don't want to build tools that don't want to be shut down. This is dangerous as those tools become more and more autonomous and smarter and smarter.
Listening to that, but at this big conference, Professor Dame Wendy Hall, one of the world's leading computing scientists and member of the UN's high-level advisory body on artificial intelligence, among many other things. Good morning. Good morning. Have we got Wendy there? Professor Dame Wendy Hall? We're having, we're having a streak here, like Justin.
Comedy of... turn. I tell you what, then, we have got Simon French.
Don't boast that your guest has returned. We'll get Dame Wendy Hall in a moment. It's good to introduce them and then go back to them.
Yeah, exactly. And Simon French is, I'm told, on the line. Morning to you, Simon.
Good morning, Justin.
Right ahead. So just in case anyone has just switched on and was wondering what on earth is going on, we were talking about the inflation figures. We were doing it with Grant Fitzner, the chief economist at the ONS, who was telling us basically they're in line with expectations, which he seemed to be suggest to the Bank of England that interest rates can now come down a little. Is that your view, Simon? Does the inflation figure today, the 3%, mean that the door is open now for interest rate cuts?
It is. It's worth reminding listeners that the vote was 5-4 on the 9-person policy committee at the last meeting. And therefore, it only takes a little bit of additional evidence of what the bank will describe as disinflationary, not outright deflation, but slowing inflation, to pip one of those two members, either the governor, Andrew Bailey, or one of the external members, Catherine Mann, to shift their vote. So the market is pricing, as we speak, about an 80% chance of a rate cut in March.
And it's not just inflation, is it? It's growth, which is flat. It's unemployment, which is higher than it has been, particularly youth unemployment, something we're going to be talking about later on. In other words, the total picture points in that direction. Is that right?
I think it's the interplay of the two. So it is the degree to which the Monetary Policy Committee, who, of course, have to make policy based on what they expect inflation to be on an 18-month, two-year window, the degree to which the softness we saw in yesterday's labour market, the softness we've seen in recent growth data, will actually put downward pressure on the pricing power of companies, wage settlements, the type of things that will generate a sustained inflation rate in 2 years' time. And the weaker those signals are, the more confidence the Bank of England will have to do multiple rate cuts this year.
Rachel Reeves, Chancellor, has just said, thanks to the choices we made at the budget, we are bringing inflation down. What's your view of that?
So she is correct in the perspective of last November's budget. Both the bank and the Office of Budget Responsibility, and indeed my own analysis, would agree that they will put those decisions made in November will put about 0.4% downward pressure on UK inflation this year, which is encouraging. I think the part that perhaps the Chancellor didn't talk about is the reason we have had a slower interest rate cutting cycle in the UK compared to, for example, the Eurozone is because of some decisions made in the previous budget in 2024 that I think very clearly were inflationary, specifically on employer national insurance contributions that a lot of employers pass through in terms of end costs that we all face in shops.
Simon French, Chief Economist at Panmure Gordon. Thank you.
Well, let's go back to Professor Dame Wendy Hall, one of the world's leading computing scientists and member of the UN's high-level advisory body on artificial intelligence, who is at this major summit on the subject of AI happening in Delhi. Good morning.
Certainly am. Hello. Good afternoon.
It's good afternoon to you. Good morning to us. Very good to talk to you, though. I did mention, I don't know if you could hear, that there were a few logistical errors and issues, not least getting you on the line, but on the first day of this summit, they seem to be out of the way. What do you think the UK should be trying to take from this?
Well, first of all, there's 250,000 people here, right? It's quite amazing.
Yeah.
And it's very Indian. And it's full of young people. So that it's really good that the young people are here. I think the focus is very much being on labour markets. And UK has been fully engaged in all the discussions about that and the positive uses of AI. But particularly here in India, it's about access for the whole world, particularly the global south. And UK has been very supportive of that all along. So that's the focus out here, really.
You're giving a speech, is that right?
I've done it.
You've done it, okay.
Yes, for keynotes. A thousand people there, yeah.
Oh, wow. That's quite an audience, I imagine. And just the size of it is also, it's interesting to know generally how big this is. What was your focus on? What were you trying to drive home?
Well, I was driving home, actually. I picked up on some of the new UK things. We've got the National Physical Laboratory has got a new centre for AI measurement, and our AI Security Institute is forming part of a global network on AI measurement. And I think this is the new thing. It's a new science for measuring and evaluating the effect and the usefulness and the of AI tools. That's something we've got to learn to do. And I think the UK is quite leading in this. No, I know the UK is quite leading in this. And it was very exciting about being able to talk about that here today.
And the, you know, I suppose the overall learning from you, I mean, have you learned anything you didn't know about this space? And you know an awful lot more than the regular person, but you know, there will be our listeners who are concerned.
Well, I mean, yes, there's the talk about safety and guardrails, and Demis Hassabis was the talk before me, as ever. You know, this is the issue, but the key thing for me is this new way of doing the evaluation and assurance on AI products. I think we've got time to do it. The most fascinating thing here is the number of young people that are here and are so positive about it, because they've not had the scaremongering that we get. And, you know, they're seeing it as a very positive thing. There's a real buzz here. So many people, but too many people.
It definitely sounds like too many people, certainly for you, in any way of how this is being maybe run. But that energy and that positivity from young people around how AI can be used, how does that translate into some real life examples of the workforce?
For example, I mean, this happened while we were developing the internet as well. The rural farmers in India, who may not necessarily be able to read or write, they need to ask questions about their crops and what they should be putting on them, how they should be dealing with them. And they can do that. AI can help them ask those questions and get the answers back that they need to be able to farm better and be more productive. And that's a really big issue here in India, is to get the whole workforce involved, and AI can really help them do that, just as the internet has done as well. And I mean, there's just so many opportunities out here, and I'm sure our companies are out here in force. You know, our Deputy Prime Minister and our AI Minister are here, and they've brought a delegation of companies with them to be selling products into the market here. So, yeah, we're getting engaged.
We'll let you carry on. Professor Dame Wendy Hall, thank you.
20 past seven is the time. Arla, the UK's biggest dairy producer, has reported record revenues of 2025. But milk prices continue to fall for farmers because of oversupply. Will is back with more. Hello again, Will.
Morning again, Justin. Yeah, Arla reported net profits of £350 million last year. But many dairy farmers are continuing to produce milk at a loss because of that oversupply issue you mentioned. Peder Tubor is with us, he's Chief Executive of Arla. Peder, morning.
Good morning.
The seriousness then of this oversupply situation.
Well, let me point out 2025 was a record year for both farmers and for Arla Foods. And remember, we are a cooperative, so we are owned by farmers. That being said, so and that can be taken away from the farmers. They had a great sailing in 25. And then the volatility kicks in globally, as always, and that's what we see now. There's an overproduction of milk momentarily. It will correct itself during the year. I feel that is what we see in the outlook. It's good that we come out now with a dividend here, because we are cooperative. We pay out 99% of all our earnings. And that will come out here in March. And at least if you're a member of Arla Foods, that will be very helpful as a farmer.
I was going to say, presumably members are under pressure though as well. I mean, what is it doing to price?
Well, what it does is that we have seen that the prices on the consumer side have slided a bit, and I guess that's very natural. It's not the first time we see it. The volatility is very strong in our dairy industry. I've been the CEO now for more than 20 years, and the prices go up and down. We will see that on the current dip that the prices will go up again during the year of 26, and that's just how our industry is working.
This seems pretty acute, though, doesn't it? We've seen people in kind of the UK papers, farmers talking about, you know, making thousands of pounds of losses every time they step out to work.
Yeah, I have to say that in at least in the case of Arla farmers, in 2025 was a record earning year for our farmers. So I can only speak on the behalf of our farmers.
Some of your competitors, Müller, Freshways, others have talked about potentially pouring milk away. Is that something that you guys have considered?
No, we would like to avoid that. We have seen here over the winter that there has been an overproduction of milk coming from the farm side, and there is simply no market in the UK for that milk. That puts pressure on the market. It's not something that we want to see. We want to see our good milk, great nutrition being used as nutrition, and we're doing everything we can. We're investing at the moment in Arla Foods in the UK more than £300 million in several of our sites to make sure that there's a capacity for all the milk that the farmers are producing.
Yeah, what are the other kind of lessons, I suppose, from this oversupply picture to try and not make this an annual thing?
Well, I, as I said, I've been around in my current chair for 20 years, and volatility is a global phenomenon. It's not something that we can fix neither in the UK or Scandinavia or wherever we are. It's simply farmers reacting to good prices. The prices were great, I have to say. The earnings on farms were great in 2025. And of course, the farmers, also because they had a great harvest in most cases in all over Europe, produced a lot. And at the moment, they're producing slightly a bit too much. And then the market spills over and reacts with lower prices. It will correct itself. That's how the market always functions.
Peter, thanks so much for your time this morning. Peter Tubor there, the chief executive of Arla.
Thanks very much. Well, it's 24 minutes past seven. Here on Today, we are marking the National Year of Reading, that initiative, which is focused on getting more people of all ages reading for pleasure. How's it going? We're in February. You doing well? I could be doing a lot better. Some of the best known authors are reading from the book that ignited or reignited their love of reading for the programme. And this morning, it's the turn of Ken Follett, the best-selling thriller writer, who sold over 198 million copies worldwide and known for works including Eye of the Needle and The Pillars of the Earth. He's chosen Live and Let Die by Ian Fleming, first published in 1954 by Jonathan Cape.
When I was 12 years old, I'd read just about all the books in the children's section of the local public library in the North London suburb of Kenton, and so they let me into the grown-up section. The staff assured my parents that they would monitor the books I chose and made sure I didn't borrow anything unsuitable for children. They never made the least attempt to keep that promise, which is how I came to read Live and Let Die by Ian Fleming, one of the early James Bond novels. I thought it was the greatest book ever written. The opening sentence is, "There are moments of great luxury in the life of a secret agent." The line is short and it packs a punch, a bit like a martini. Bond took me into a world of which I had no experience. I'd never met anybody who'd been to America, and all of Live and Let Die takes place in the United States, almost all. I remember asking my father what a martini was, and he said, "I think it's some kind of drink." He actually had no idea what a martini was. And the cigarettes and the fast cars and the hotels, all of this was just a magical world to a 12-year-old boy. In the climax of Live and Let Die, Bond goes underwater in a scuba diving suit, something Fleming liked to do in the Caribbean. Here is what Bond sees. There were no big fish about, but many lobsters were out of their holes, looking huge and prehistoric in the magnifying lens of the water. Their stalk-like eyes glared redly at him, and their foot-long spined antennae asked him for the password. Occasionally, they scuttled nervously backwards into their shelters, their powerful tails kicking up the sand, and crouched on the tips of their eight hairy feet, waiting for the danger to pass. Once, the great streamers of a Portuguese man-o-war floated solely by. They almost reached his head from the surface, 15 feet away, and he remembered the whiplash of a sting from the contact of one of their tendrils that had burned for 3 days at Manatee Bay. If they caught a man across the heart, they could kill him. Wide sea fans swayed and beckoned in the eddies, and in the grey valleys they caught the light of the moon and waved spectrally like fragments of the shrouds of men buried at sea. Description in a novel is boring unless it does more than describe, and what Fleming is doing in this passage is painting the beautiful underwater landscape in words that create a terrific sense of menace. Huge and prehistoric, spined antennae, 8 hairy feet, the whiplash of a sting. We're already sitting on the edge of our seats, and we haven't even seen the octopus yet. When I began to write novels myself, 10 years after that first encounter with James Bond, I started to write thrillers because I loved thrillers. But more importantly, I remembered vividly the thrill of having a new Bond novel in my hands, knowing how much I was going to enjoy it. And I resolved that what I wanted as a writer was to give my readers that feeling of delicious anticipation.
Ken Follett on Ian Fleming brings us to 28 minutes past seven. And to the sport, here's Carthy.
Morning, thank you very much. Real Madrid's Champions League playoff tie at Benfica was halted for 10 minutes after Vinicius Jr. reported alleged racist abuse to the referee last night. The Brazilian forward had just put Real 1-0 ahead. That was the final score. We can speak to the Spanish football journalist, Guillaume Balague, who was at the game at Estadio de Luz. Guillaume, there are not many instances of a referee stopping a match for this reason and players leaving the field. Can you just give us an idea of what happened? And you're also in the tunnel afterwards. What was the post-match atmosphere like?
Yes, Cathy, it doesn't happen often, but still happens in 2026, which is unbelievable. And in this case, on the back of, according to Vinicius, a racial insult from a rival player. Basically, when Vinicius scores, he goes to his own half, and before kickoff takes place again, Gianluca Pastriani, the Benfica player, raises his shirt to hide his face and said something. Vinicius hears insults, he calls him a monkey and runs to the referee. Referee doesn't even doubt, crosses his arms. That's the indication to everyone in the stadium that the game is going to be stopped because a player has suffered racist abuse. From then on, and that's where Vinicius said in his statement later on that the protocol is not right, that it's up to Vinicius himself, the victim, to actually decide if the game goes on or not, because the referee had not heard what had happened. And his own manager, Arbeloa, went to Vinicius and said, what do you want to do? Because if you want to leave the pitch, we're coming with you. And even Mourinho, the Benfica manager, Jose Mourinho, went to Vinicius to say to him that Benfica is not a racist club, that the biggest icon in the history of Benfica is a black player, Eusebio, and why did he have to celebrate the way he did? So under all that pressure, the question was put to him again, to Vinicius, if he wanted to play or not, backed up by Mbappé, who said he heard as well 5 times that insult. Basically, they decided to continue the game. And at the end of the game, in the tunnel, the first player to come through the tunnel, and I was just there waiting for interviews in the flesh zone, it's called, the first interviews after the game. It was first Mbappé shouting loudly that what had happened was completely inconceivable, and Vinicius as well. And then a bunch of players and officials from both teams started shouting at each other. There was no only verbal aggression, if you like. And then the statements came out, first from Vinicius, saying that that this has happened before and that he doesn't trust what authorities may do next. Mbappé, in his social media, asked Vinicius to dance and celebrate in whatever way he wanted. And that was a reference to another commentary that Jose Mourinho did after the game, in which he basically linked the insult to the way Vinicius celebrated, suggesting that he had provoked the fans.
Yep.
So, yes, we are hearing this story, and that sounds familiar, but the reactions, including the bad ones, are also familiar, too familiar.
Yeah, yeah, very familiar. And a lot of the commentators and pundits that were involved, Thierry Henry, Clarence Theodore, Theo Walcott, Trent Alexander-Arnold, have all condemned the abuse. Gianluca Prestiani has put up a statement saying, "I want to clarify that at no time did I direct racist insults to Real Madrid player Vinicius Jr., who was regrettably misunderstood what he thought he heard from me." They meet again next week. These things normally take quite a lot of time. Is there? What are the next steps?
Yes. Let me just add one thing about Patriani, because he actually told his teammates and them to some Real Madrid players that it wasn't a racist insult. It was an homophobe insult, as if. He will be punished somehow if he had said something clean, if you like. He didn't need to raise his shirt to hide his face or his mouth. But as you say, everything goes very slowly now. UEFA will have to investigate, talk to Vinicius, to Pratiani, to Mbappé, yep, to everybody who heard it. And that may take a while. The problem they're going to find is that there's going to be no conclusive evidence, and it will be the word of three or four, yep, or whoever heard it, against
with the hidden shirt, the mouth being covered by the shirt. Yeah. Gaël Balaguer, thank you very much for explaining what has happened in that situation. And just to mention that at the Winter Olympics, Team GB's curling hopes are in jeopardy. They lost 9-5 to Canada. They are now in danger of not reaching the semi-finals.
Garthy, thank you. It's 27 minutes to 8. Let me tell you about what's coming up this lunchtime on Radio 4 here on the network. It continues its look at the side effects of certain prescription drugs.
If personalities are partly shaped by chemicals in our brains, what can happen when one of these chemicals gets a boost?
He looked like my dad and sounded like my dad, but it was an entirely different person.
I'm Noel Titheridge, and I've been uncovering the shocking side effects linked to medications for movement disorders, which affect the activity of dopamine.
I was gambling on all sorts of things, and I lost 25 grand in a night.
If these dangers were known about for decades, why were so many patients and families left in the dark? Impulsive continues this afternoon at 1:45 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
To the weather. It's going to be dry with variable cloud this morning, and then it will be overcast. Outbreaks of rain pushing in from the north.
Coming up in the next half hour, so stay with us for this. We have been talking about it's a bit colder, but if we turn our attention to the Winter Olympics, we'll be explaining how skiing and mountaineering, SkiMo, as it's known, has grown as a sport and is making its debut at the Games.
You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Emma Barnett and Justin Webb. It is just coming up to 25 to 8. Caroline Nichols has the news.
Figures released in the past hour show the rate of inflation, as measured by the Consumer Prices Index, fell to 3% in the 12 months to January. That's compared with 3.4% in the previous month. Grant Fitzner from the Office for National Statistics told us the fall was driven by cheaper petrol and diesel prices, a small fall in food costs and lower airfares. The BBC understands the government is considering slowing down plans to pay adults of all ages the same minimum wage. Labour pledged in its manifesto to remove discretionary age bans and to increase the wages of 18 to 20-year-olds so they're paid the same as those over 21. Speaking on this programme, the Welsh Secretary, Joe Stevens, said the proposal to delay implementation, as first reported in the Times newspaper, wasn't government policy. The National Crime Agency has warned the threat to children from online sexual abuse is getting worse, with the number of arrests rising sharply to 1,000 every month. The agency is urging tech companies to step up efforts to tackle the problem, warning that many images are being found on social media and mainstream platforms. One of the country's leading psychiatrists has warned that there's a silent mental health pandemic in England. The president of the Royal College of Psychiatrists, Dr. Ladda Smith, said the longer the scale of the challenge was ignored, the harder it would be to overcome. The Department of Health said it had made almost £700 million of extra investment in mental health services this year. Donald Trump's special envoy, Steve Witkoff, says talks between Ukraine and Russia, which are being held in the Swiss city of Geneva, have led to meaningful progress to try to stop the war. Ahead of a second day of negotiations, Ukraine's President Zelensky has criticised Mr. Trump's repeated insistence that his country make concessions, saying this isn't fair.
Thanks very much. It's 24 minutes to eight. Negotiators from Ukraine and Russia concluded the first 2 days of those US-mediated peace talks in Geneva. That was at the end of yesterday, with the US President Donald Trump pressing Kyiv to act fast to reach a deal to try to end that four-year conflict. The president talked about the peace talks on the phone to Sir Keir Starmer last night. And yet, are we any closer? Earlier, I spoke to the BBC's international editor, Jeremy Bowen.
I'm in eastern Ukraine at the moment, working out of the city of Kharkiv, which is very close to the areas of Donbass, which is the areas which the intense fighting in eastern Ukraine has been going on. And what's happening really is that it is now a very different kind of war. It's not those things we saw at the beginning, artillery and trenches. It's a drone war now, and the area around the confrontation line on both sides for really many miles, both the Ukrainians and the Russians, have turned it into what both sides actually call a kill zone, because if they see people moving around, they can kill them with drones. So that's a very, very intense and different and difficult warfare. And people here, I think, are very conscious of the fact that the Russians are saying consistently that if there's going to be a ceasefire, then the price of it is that the Ukrainians are going to have to pull out of those areas of a province, a district called Donetsk, that they haven't lost to the Russians, and just give them up. But strategically, that is really difficult for the Ukrainians, because they're militarily important. And of course, there's this whole idea of giving up territory that they bled and died for. So I've been talking to the commander of one of the main fighting units in the army. He's called Brigadier General Oleksandr Pivnenko. So I asked, what, in his opinion, does victory for Ukraine look like?
For me personally, it means stopping the killing of our soldiers and the civilian population of Ukraine by the enemy military that attacked us. In military terms, of course, it means taking back our territories. I understand that perhaps this is not realistic today, but potentially in the future it is very important.
But for now, is the priority simply survival?
I believe that at the moment the priority is a ceasefire and survival.
I've listened to Donald Trump a lot since he became president again. The things he said about Ukraine. And he often gives the impression that he believes that you're losing, that you have to make a deal because otherwise you are going to lose. Is that correct?
We are losing territories, yes. But you know, we are a very difficult opponent in this war. The price Russia is paying for this war is very high. We may be losing territories, that is true, but we are striking their economy, their manpower, and their equipment. These are very important factors. For them, the wartime period may not feel as hard, but after the war, it will be much harder, because they will have to explain to their people what this war was for, and what the losses were.
It is 4 years now since the Russians mounted the full-scale invasion of Ukraine. Aren't people tired? Don't they just want this whole thing to end?
I'm sure people are tired. Civilians are tired, the military is tired, and the country's leadership is tired. Everyone feels this fatigue. But everyone wants the war to end, I'm sure of that. The main question for us is, at what price? A ceasefire. I think everyone would agree to that. And then a reassessment of further actions, agreements and so on. But loss of territory? Let's say, we will not give anything away. I'm sure of that. Every Ukrainian you ask will tell you the same. No one will give anything away just like that.
It's fascinating to hear that, Jeremy. And I wonder if you can share the sense that you have of how it is for Ukraine in terms of the front line at the moment. Ukraine has had some successes, hasn't it?
Yeah, well, further south of here, in the province, the district called Zaporizhia, which is around a big city of that name, the Ukrainians have regained quite a bit, a significant amount of territory. The Russians had been advancing there, and a major reason for that is that Elon Musk has found a way of switching off the Starlink terminals, which both sides use here, but he's found a way of switching off the Russian ones. And that is causing them real problems. But I've spoken to a lot of drone units here, and they say that they think the Russians will find a workaround. But for the time being, it is definitely affecting their operational capacities on that front line, and the Ukrainians have taken advantage of that. My impression is that, you know, they're still, despite the tiredness the general was talking about, they are still very determined that they are getting supplies. They feel that the Europeans are behind them. Of course, Zelensky, the president, has said more than once that the Europeans could do a lot more. But no, I think I do not see signs of this war ending, I have to say, unless there is some extraordinary development at the Geneva talks, which would involve big movement from not just from the Russians, but also from the Americans. It was very interesting to hear Donald Trump yesterday, I think, saying the Ukrainians better make sure they get to the table on this. It always seems to be his instinct that when you have to put pressure on someone, you don't put it on Moscow, you put it on Kiev.
Jeremy Bowen, thank you.
18 minutes to 8. Skimo makes its debut at the Winter Olympics tomorrow. Skimo is skiing and mountaineering. It's the game's newest sport. And Andy Bryce is on the line, who is the chair of the British Mountaineering Council Skimo Steering Group. Morning to you, Andy.
Morning, Justin. How are you?
Good, thanks. Tell us what it is, first of all. What do you actually have to do?
So it's a mixed discipline, and it combines a load of different elements of mountaineering. So in the games, you'll see people skiing downhill. You'll see them skinning uphill, so what a lot of people will know recreationally as touring, and then you'll see them also with their skis on their backs running, so there'll be bootpack sections as well. So it's a real combination of different mountaineering sports.
And does the mountaineering part of it actually involve kind of proper mountaineering? Are you got crampons and all the rest of it and ice axes or not?
So you can do. We won't see that in the Olympics because this is the first year, so they're starting with some easier races or some easier versions of the race. But in the long ski mountaineering races, the big classic races, yes, certainly you would see that. You'd see people with ice axes, with crampons. Sometimes they have to carry safety equipment. And I hope the Olympics does go that way in the future. But as a sort of test piece this year, it would be much shorter races.
And it's new for the Olympics, but not new as a sport.
No, so it spawns from what we would call military patrol races, which have been around for hundreds of years in the Alps, and as a sport that's been serious, it's been around since sort of the early 90s. So not new as a sport, but yeah, certainly first time in the Olympics this year. It's very exciting.
Are Brits any good at it?
Yeah, so we're getting better. So it's we suffer, as with a lot of winter disciplines, that we don't have the snow conditions, and it's a bit more difficult to train. And we actually only started up as a formal GB team back in the 24-25 season. So unfortunately, we don't have any athletes competing this year. We would have liked to. We set it as a bit of a stretch goal, and we surprisingly we came really close, and that's because we've got some really great young GB athletes, and we've definitely got 2030 in our sights. And even just in the last couple of months, we've had some great results. We've had our first gold medal for a female at the World Masters Championships, and our top male athlete won a race in France called the Pointe Blanche, which was a great result. But unfortunately, we just started a bit too late to make it to the Winter Olympics.
Right, but next time round, you would expect then to be there.
I would really, really hope so. And I think if we continue on current form, certainly we've got a great chance.
Well, what is it that attracts people to it? Because, I mean, is it the kind of all-round ruggedness of it as a discipline almost as well as a sport, or what?
I think it goes back to the sort of roots of mountaineering. So it's when you see people doing ski mountaineering, it really looks like they're out in the hills, and they're using different modes of transport to get across the terrain in front of them. And it's really genuinely very exciting. There's lots of different bits to it, the lots of different skills. You have to be a really good, competent downhill skier. You have to be really competent on the mountain terrain. You have to be incredibly fit, so almost, hill runner type fitness to get up the steeps. And then also the transitions are incredibly important as well. I think what people watching it will find most exciting is when you see people transitioning from uphill to downhill, and they're taking the skins on and off the skis, The speed they have to do that is quite incredible.
Yeah. Okay, well, people will be fascinated by that and very much hoping to see your people there next time round. Andy Bryce, Chair of the British Mountaineering Council SCIMO Steering Group. Thank you.
It's 14 minutes to 8, the time now for Thought for the Day. And the speaker this morning, Canon Angela Tilby.
Good morning. This week, the final phase of the COVID-19 inquiry has begun, looking at the impact of the pandemic on society and making recommendations. 6 years on from the first lockdown, many of us remember the chill of fear that gripped us at that time. Cut off from our normal routines, we felt suddenly vulnerable. Today is Ash Wednesday, the beginning of Lent, which coincides this year with the start of Ramadan. Fasting, abstinence and good works prepare Christians for Easter and Muslims for Eid. It's as though we have an instinct that we need from time to time to abstain from the usual good things of life and live differently. In Christian tradition, observing Lent is a way of imitating Christ, who spent 40 days and 40 nights fasting in the wilderness at the start of his mission. Everything about that story in the Gospels suggests that it was a struggle. Jesus was vulnerable. He experienced loneliness, hunger, even a face-to-face encounter with the devil, who offered fantasies of power and success. None of us enjoy feeling vulnerable. The word itself comes from the Latin word for wound, and in normal life we spend a lot of time and energy in trying to prevent or deny our woundedness. Ash Wednesday invites us to do the opposite, to accept our vulnerability. Many of us will go to church today and will receive ashes traced on our foreheads. In spite of all that we're told about the importance of believing in ourselves, in the end we are dust, and to dust we shall return. Vulnerability is built into our existence from our first cry to our last breath. You might well wonder why we should welcome this, why it's part of the Christian gospel, the good news. When I take part year by year in the ashing of Ash Wednesday, I'm often surprised by my immediate visceral response. You might think it would be dread, but in fact it's the opposite. It's more like relief. Remember you are dust, and to dust you shall return, is a practice run for the vulnerability of being human. Age, illness, betrayal and death. Remember you are dust puts in perspective the attempts to ward off mortality through money or knowledge or power. It enables us to listen to our bodies, to recognise the difference between needs and addictive cravings, to distinguish between seductive fantasies and the reality of who we are. Julia de Bursobra, a Russian spiritual writer, once said that suffering was not only inevitable, but potentially creative. What am I going to do? What am I going to become to make good use of my short time on this earth?
That was Thought for the Day with Canon Angela Tilby. It's 11 minutes to 8.
We have the highest youth unemployment rate for more than a decade. Does it then make sense to make it more expensive to hire young people? Alan Milburn, the former Labour Cabinet Minister, told us yesterday we need to maximise the incentives for employers and minimise the risks. A government source has told The Times that the youth unemployment figures strengthen the case, as the source put it, for a rethink of the government's manifesto commitment to raise the youth minimum wage level to match older workers. In other words, they might not do it. The BBC's been told ministers are considering at least slowing down the plans. But earlier on the programme, the Welsh Secretary, Jo Stephens, told us that Labour was still committed to the policy.
We've had many naysayers over the years about the national minimum wage. People said in 1998 that it would cause mass unemployment, and it didn't. And every time there is a rise in the national minimum wage, people complain about it. The fact is, people shouldn't be on poverty wages. This is a minimum wage, not a maximum wage. And it's quite right that people are paid well for the job that they do.
And it is also the case this week that the Employment Act, other bits of the Employment Act, did come into force, essentially making it slightly easier to strike. Let us talk about all these things with Andy Prendergast, who's the National Secretary of the GMB Union. They represent workers across public utilities, engineering, food and drink, manufacturing, etc. And Luke Johnson as well, the entrepreneur, former chairman of Pizza Express, currently director of Gales and Brompton Bicycles. Good morning to you both. Andy Prendergast, first of all, can I just start with what the Times seems to be suggesting, that there are people behind the scenes suggesting that the commitment, and it is a commitment, was a commitment in the manifesto, to raise the minimum wage for youth workers to match the minimum wage for everyone else, that that commitment should be watered down or at least delayed. Jo Stephens there denying it effectively, but of course the government does deny things and then changes its mind. If they were to do it, what would your union think?
Well, we'd be extremely unhappy about that. You know, this is a manifesto promise. This has been our union's policy for a long period of time. Younger workers are not less productive. Businesses hire on the basis of need. They don't employ more young workers than they would older workers. You know, and fundamentally, I think this is the wrong prescription for the problem. As Joe says, you know, we've had the minimum wage of 27 years. We've been repeatedly told that it will lead to unemployment. That's never happened. And yet these people are listened to time and time again, and they come out with the same prescription for the same problem. And that's what we're hearing again.
Let's turn then to the substance of this. And I suppose the substance of some of the things that Andy Prendergast just brought up, Luke Johnson. When you hear that, you think what?
Well, what I think, it's a tragedy that nearly one in five young men in the UK don't have a job. And the idea that that isn't a crisis for society, I don't know what to say. And the reason is, I can tell you, I've spent 40 years growing businesses and creating jobs. And the mood amongst employers and those who invest in this country is the darkest I've ever seen. And I think the idea that we are bringing in this Employment Rights Act at this moment, when it's very clear that vacancies are a third of what they were, and that unemployment is at a multi-year high and only going in one direction, is very dangerous. Because I think with the arrival of AI and other external factors, Morgan Stanley have published a report which says that Britain is likely to be the most damaged by the rise of AI. As Andy and I were talking about earlier, there's up to a million drivers' jobs that may disappear over the next few years because of autonomous driving. And the government is making it more expensive and more risky to employ people. And so I think entrepreneurs and managers will not create the jobs.
Isn't that the simple point, Andy Prendergast, that you should make it as cheap as possible to hire younger people in order that they get a start?
Well, look, firstly, I mean, when we're talking about the youth unemployment, I mean, I agree, it is a big problem and it is a problem that needs to be dealt with. However, it's been on the uptick for a very long time. So the idea that somehow this law, which, as you say, hasn't even come in, you know, we're not looking at equalising the rates yet. The idea that that is the reason for something that has been going up for over a decade, that is just a nonsense.
Well, I think employers are saying it'll make it worse.
Well, I mean, but employers often, you know, employers told us the minimum wage would make things worse. Employers told us union rights would make things worse. You know, employers tell us that every single improvement in workers' rights is going to cause a problem. And time again, they have been proved wrong. Now, you look at the strong economies of Northern Europe, for example, they managed to combine...
Well, Denmark has some of the easiest legislation when it comes to making restructurings of businesses in the world.
Well, it does. But if you look at, you know, I was in Denmark a couple of years ago, and when you look at it, for example, their dole money is about 90% of your wages. That tends to mean that you have support from employers, from municipal government and from unions to restructure.
It's a very, very different system.
It is
Denmark.
A very different
system. I mean, the reason I think, just to concentrate on Denmark for a minute, because we've done quite a lot of it on this programme. So we went there and looked at their system. It is a very different way of, it's much more inclusive of everyone, including the employers. I'm not sure it sort of translates across, does it?
No, but ultimately what I'm saying is there is not this correlation between pay, rights and employment levels. You know, if you look at large countries that have low pay and no rights, they also have high unemployment. They have huge insecurity.
That is true, isn't it?
No, not necessarily. America doesn't.
Well, America is one example, and as I said, we can pick America, and if we're talking about different countries, and America, so much of it is based in states, then I don't see how on one level we can't use Denmark while we can't use America on the other.
But what is it, though, that you believe, Luke Johnson, is the link between a higher minimum wage for young people and people being unwilling to employ them? In other words, is it simply that this is too costly, or is it also that the quality of work that they're getting, if you like, from a young person, that they are actually effectively less productive because they are the age that they are?
Well, it's almost inevitable, isn't it, that if someone is less experienced and less well-trained than someone who's been doing a job for a while, they're not necessarily going to be as productive. I mean, I think the timing of this Employment Rights Act is what the tragedy is because I think it's coming at a point when we are likely to see in the coming years a substantial rise in unemployment for all sorts of reasons. And I think you know, we will see, because of that, a great deal of unhappiness, a lower standard of living overall, less tax raises.
Let me put that to Andy Prendergast, though. Do you not accept that for an employer, a younger person is less productive than an older person? And for that reason, it's perfectly fair, actually, that they're paid less.
Well, firstly, the rules at the moment do allow that. We've argued that they shouldn't, and we will continue to argue that. I think, firstly, you can't use a uniform approach on this. There's lots of young workers who come into the workplace who are exceptionally enthusiastic, who want to get on. Most of us were there at some point or another. You know, when I was 18, when I was 19, I had jobs. I worked next to people who were older. They weren't necessarily better. When we're talking about the minimum wage as well, we're talking about no pre-skills. You know, these are not people coming in with years of customer service experience. These are often people who haven't worked in that industry before, which is why they're going for those level of wages. You know, we're not looking at highly qualified computer programmers or doctors or nurses. They are older. They are skilled.
Final thought from you, Luke Johnson. This government came into power saying it was talking to business, listening to business. They had a great outreach to business. Do you think they still are?
I don't think they've ever listened to business. I don't think they understand business. No one in this cabinet has ever been in a business. None of them have ever created any jobs. And I'm afraid to say there is a bigger disconnect between this government and the business people I know than any government I've ever come across.
Luke Johnson, Andy Prendergast, thank you both.
At 3 minutes to eight, here's Alan Davis with an intriguing question for you.
What if, tomorrow, something essential to our world simply disappeared? Join me, Alan Davis, as I sit down with some of the brightest minds to reveal what would really unfold if the unthinkable were to become real. From the moon to a life without worms, bees, or sex, what would really happen if the foundations of life were suddenly pulled away? Life Without, with me, Alan Davis. Friday afternoons at 2:45. To listen on your smart speaker, just say, play Radio 4.
Play the weather. Here's Ben Rich.
Thank you, Justin. Morning to you. Some rain and indeed some snow for some of us as we go through the course of today, especially in western, central and southern parts of the UK. Let's start across the southwest of England, the southeast of England, eastern England. A lot of cloud around in these areas through today with some outbreaks of rain turning increasingly heavy and persistent as we go through into the afternoon. There could be some issues with flooding in southern counties of England. And then for Wales and for the Midlands, again, a lot of cloud around, some rain in initially quite light and patchy, a few flakes of snow over high ground in Wales, and then as we see heavier rain pushing northwards this afternoon, we will increasingly, I think, see that rain turning to snow over high ground, say above 150, 200 metres elevation, the hills of Wales, high ground in the Midlands, could start to see some snow as we go through the late afternoon into the evening, and that could cause some disruption. Northern England, mostly cloudy today, mostly dry, but we will see some rain and hill snow later on. Northern Ireland looks very cloudy and wet, some heavy and persistent rain with some snow over high ground, windy here as well. Many parts of Scotland will be dry but cloudy, a bit of brightness into the northeast, some patchy rain out towards the west, and temperatures across the UK 4 to 10 degrees.
Ben, thanks very much for that. You are listening to Today on Radio 4 with Justin Webb and Emma Barnett. It's 8 o'clock on Wednesday, the 18th of February. Good morning if you're just joining us. Good morning if you're already with us. The headlines. Inflation has fallen to its lowest level since last March, partly because of lower petrol prices and slower rises in the cost of food. The BBC understands that ministers are considering slowing down the increase in the youth minimum wage. And a leading psychiatrist has warned there is a silent mental health pandemic in England, with NHS services unable to cope.
And also coming up in this hour, a new exhibition celebrates this moment.
All right, so here we are, one of the elephants. Cool thing about these guys is that they have really, really, really long trunks.
Doesn't sound much, does it? But it was the first video on YouTube, and its co-founder was there at a zoo. We'll be delving into two decades of digital history. Plus, could this be the key to a UK win at Eurovision? Quite enough of that. The news read this morning by Caroline Nichols.
The latest figures published by the Office for National Statistics show inflation fell to 3% in the 12 months to January, down from 3.4% in the 12 months to December. Here's our business correspondent, Emma Simpson.
After a blip in December, inflation, the rate at which prices are rising, is back on a downward path and is now at its lowest level since March 2025. Falling petrol prices and an easing in the cost of airfares and food were the main drivers behind this sharp drop, as measured by the Consumer Prices Index. While overall inflation remains above the Bank of England's target, it thinks inflation will fall back to about 2% in the spring, helped by lower energy bills announced in the budget. Today's figures, along with yesterday's evidence of a weakening jobs market, make further interest rate cuts more likely, with city economists expecting the next cut as soon as March.
The BBC understands the government is considering slowing down plans to pay adults of all ages the same minimum wage. Labour pledged in its manifesto to remove discretionary age bans and to increase the wages of 18 to 20-year-olds so they're paid the same as those over 21. Here's our political correspondent, Joe Pike.
If you're 18, 19 or 20 years old, the minimum wage is currently £10 an hour. Once you reach 21, it jumps to £12.21 per hour. Labour had pledged to change that by the time of the next election, but with youth unemployment at the end of last year at just over 16%, the highest level since 2014, ministers are now looking at changing their plans. Government sources have ruled out a reversal in the commitment, but conceded that a slowing down in the equalisation of the minimum wage is under consideration. The Federation of Small Businesses has said if ministers were serious about tackling youth unemployment, they should reconsider their policies. The GMB Trade Union has said that with huge gaps in care, retail and hospitality, any change in Labour's commitment would be fundamentally wrong. Speaking on this programme, the Welsh Secretary Joe Stevens said the proposal to delay the implementation of the manifesto pledge wasn't government policy.
The National Crime Agency has warned the threat to children from online sexual abuse is getting worse, with the number of arrests rising sharply to 1,000 every month. The agency is urging tech companies to step up efforts to tackle the problem, warning that many images are being found on social media and mainstream platforms. Officials fear abusive behaviour is being normalised online. Our correspondent Nomia Iqbal has more details.
The National Crime Agency says these horrific crimes aren't just being carried out on the dark web, but on mainstream platforms online. It has found offenders have been commissioning live-stream sexual abuse of children, mainly young boys, on demand for as little as £20. It says algorithms push many abusers into parts of the online world where their behaviour is normalised and then escalates. The NCA says it is uncovering sadistic behaviour, which is far worse than it has seen before. It says police can't combat the problem alone and it wants technology companies to do more. This includes making their platforms hostile for offenders and introducing safeguards to stop children from taking, sharing or viewing nude images. It also wants there to be stronger guidance and education for parents and teachers.
One of the country's leading psychiatrists has warned that there's a silent mental health pandemic in England, which is affecting patients, society and the economy. The president of the Royal College of Psychiatrists, Dr. Ladder Smith, said the longer the scale of the challenge was ignored, the harder it would be to overcome. The Department of Health said it has made almost £700 million of extra investment in mental health services this year. Tom Fielden reports.
4.1 million people, more than a million of them children and young people, sought help from mental health services in 2024 to 25, up 56% on 8 years earlier. Dr. Smith said services were overwhelmed and under-resourced, and it was atrocious that people could only access care when they were at crisis point. The government says it's invested nearly £700 million extra in mental health services this year.
Donald Trump's special envoy, Steve Witkoff, says talks between Ukraine and Russia, which are being held in the Swiss city of Geneva, have led to meaningful progress to try to stop the war. Ahead of a second day of negotiations, Ukraine's President Zelensky has criticised Mr. Trump's repeated insistence that his country make concessions, saying this isn't fair. Our international editor, Jeremy Bowen, sent this report from Ukraine's northeastern city, Kharkiv, ahead of the fourth anniversary of Russia's full-scale invasion.
In Slovyansk and Kramatorsk, heavily defended so-called fortress cities here in eastern Ukraine, The remaining residents have to deal with attacks by Russian drones and the brutal winter cold in houses that often don't have power or heating. At the US brokered talks in Geneva, Russia's price for a ceasefire still appears to be Ukraine handing over these cities and all of the Donetsk region that it still holds. I asked Brigadier General Alexander Pivnenko, who commands Ukraine's National Guard, whether that would be acceptable.
I actually believe that this is impossible at the moment. A ceasefire along the line of contact is something we can still understand, but no one will give up territories. If there is an order to withdraw, then we will withdraw. But will the population of our country accept that?
Brigadier Pivnenko said that if Ukraine had wanted to give up territory in Donetsk, it could have done so when Russia mounted the full-scale invasion almost exactly 4 years ago.
Pharmacies in England have warned they'll have to make cuts to services unless there's a significant increase in government funding. In a letter to the health secretary, the National Pharmacy Association said some chemists are at risk of imminent closure due to intolerable financial pressures. Negotiations between the NHS and the community pharmacy sector on a new contract begin soon. Our health editor Hugh Pym reports.
The National Pharmacy Association says some members are reducing opening hours and services because government funding hasn't kept up with costs. Some pharmacists report not taking a salary and digging into pension savings to stay afloat. 1,400 high street chemists in England have closed since 2017, and the association says more will follow without extra government support. The Department of Health said they were working hard to turn around a decade of underfunding and neglect, and pharmacies were central in the shift towards community-based care.
A man leading the hunt for the 84-year-old mother of the American TV presenter Savannah Guthrie says he believes she was the victim of a targeted kidnapping and is being held somewhere close to her home in Arizona. In a BBC interview, Sheriff Chris Nanos condemned what he called sensationalised media coverage of the investigation of the disappearance of Nancy Guthrie more than 2 weeks ago. Sheriff Nanos was speaking to our correspondent, David Willis.
I think she's somewhere here in our community.
Locally?
Yeah.
What makes you think that?
I just do. I don't know why. I don't have any evidence to prove that, but I just believe that she's somewhere here locally.
Research from the think tank The Health Foundation suggests almost 80% of private prescriptions for weight loss drugs such as Mounjaro and Wegovy are for women, with uptake peaking in the 30 to 39 age bracket. The research also showed that people living in wealthy areas were much more likely to use the injections, despite obesity rates being significantly higher in poorer places. Samantha Field, a senior fellow at the Health Foundation and co-author of the study, told this programme if that pattern continued, it would have a significant impact on health inequalities.
We can see that prescription rates are almost 30% lower in the most deprived areas. But when you factor in that obesity is almost twice as common in the poorest areas, this gap gets much bigger. The implication is we have an almost 20-year gap in healthy life expectancy between the most and least deprived populations.
The Chartered Trading Standards Institute has issued a warning about illegal skin lightening products, which pose a serious health risk. The Institute says the products are being sold in an increasingly wide range of shops across the UK, as well as on social media platforms. Here's our business reporter, Lucy Hooker.
Trading Standards says a growing number of unscrupulous small shop owners are seeking to cash in on the demand for creams that promise to lighten the user's skin tone, but which can cause skin thinning, organ damage, and other serious long-term health complications. The watchdog says specialist food shops and even butchers are joining online sellers in offering the banned items. One cosmetics retailer in Peckham, London, was fined £30,000 last year after Trading Standards was alerted. The watchdog is asking the public to report any suspicious cosmetic products or if they suffer any adverse reactions.
Lucy Hooker reporting.
Thanks very much, Caroline. It's 10 minutes past eight. When one of our leading psychiatrists says we are in the middle of a silent mental health pandemic, shouldn't we listen? Shouldn't we act? Especially as she's about to finish her term as president of the Royal College of Psychiatrists and has nothing to lose by being as honest as possible. In a moment, we'll talk to her. We'll hear directly from Dr. Lade Smith, who's pushing for urgent change to stop care only becoming available often when people reach crisis point. But take this in. 4.1 million people sought help from mental health services in 2024 to 2025. That's a 56% increase on the 2.6 million who got in contact in 2016 to 17. That figure includes more than a million children and young people. Yesterday, if you were with us and able to hear the programme, we spoke to Alan Milburn, the former Health Secretary and now Chair of the Government's Young People and Work Review, looking at young people not in education, employment or training, the so-called NEETs. And he spoke about the impact that both mental illness and neurodiverse conditions are having.
What is obvious is that it's a more anxious generation. That's not peculiar to the UK. That's true across the world. There's rising neurodiversity conditions, autism, ADHD. That seems to be happening everywhere. What seems to be peculiar to the United Kingdom is that these conditions are translating into economic inactivity at a scale that is markedly different from other countries. So our NEET rates, for example, are treble those of Holland, twice those of Japan or Ireland. And we're looking at those countries to understand what they're doing that is better. So there's evidence that we can bring back. This is not inevitable, what's going on. It can be addressed. What we can't have is a situation where a young person is diagnosed with a condition, then automatically, which is what the system almost seems to do at the moment, say, you're not fit to work. The best that we can aspire to you for this generation is a lifetime on benefits. That's a lifetime on the scrap heap.
Alan Milburn, strong words there. Emma Carter is the chief executive of the Bristol-based consultancy Westspring IT, and she's told us about the impact that rising mental illness is having on smaller businesses like hers.
So we see the obvious trend of absences rising. We also see a trend around the impact that it has on our managers and our people. So we want to be supportive. We want to help. We want to do the right thing. But that workload still has to happen. So everybody ends up sort of carrying a workload or feeling an element of pressure or an impact on them personally as a consequence. Short-term absence is one of those things a business has to deal with and make adjustments for. But when it turns into long-term, 6, 8, 12 weeks and longer, what do you do as a business? You're still paying somebody for their absence. We are hiring at the moment, actually. So what we are seeing is gaps in CVs, but you can't exactly ask somebody in an interview, what does that look like? It's the moral dilemma as well that we constantly juggle with. We want to do right. We can't always afford to do right. So what does that then mean? What do you do? It's really difficult.
Listening to that, and just joined us in the studio then, Dr. Lade Smith, President of the Royal College of Psychiatrists. Good morning.
Good morning.
A silent mental health pandemic. I mean, we were just hearing some of the case around the economy, around businesses. But one of your key points, as I understand it, is we need to act a lot quicker. Because even if you just hear from the CEO of a smaller business there, you don't want something going on from a business point of view, but from a health point of view as a person or someone you love for a long time, do you?
Absolutely right. So mental illnesses are common and they are disorders of youth. So 75% of mental illness arises before the age of 24, 50% before the age of 14. So once you've survived the infectious diseases of childhood, the most likely condition that you'll suffer from as a young person is a mental illness. And just as Alan Milburn said, this is not just a UK problem. This is a problem worldwide. One in eight people in the world suffers from a mental illness. That's over a billion people.
Was it always the case, do we think?
So without a doubt, there's been an increase in the number of the number of mental illnesses across the world. And the WHO has said that since about 1990, there's been an increase in mental illness. But that coincides with the increase in a number of the social factors that increase the risk of mental illness. So we know that about 78% of mental illnesses are driven by social factors such as financial insecurity, debt, poverty, trauma, you know, the way in which you're treated as you're growing up, particularly for children. So adverse childhood experiences, being exposed to violence, being abused physically, sexually, emotionally, all increase the risk of developing a mental illness when you're older. And so we know that when there's war, there's famine, that increases the risk as well. So across the world, there's been an increase because there's been an increase in some of the factors that we know drive mental illnesses.
Specifically then this country, yeah. And what's going on when you hear things like we have this issue where it's stopping us from being in work, economically active? How do you read that with what you see of provision of healthcare and support?
Well, the reality is that Mental illnesses in the UK are 20% of the disease burden in the UK, but we get less than 9% of the healthcare spend. And we know that if we can treat mental illness very effectively, particularly in children and young people. So if you treat people quickly, early, particularly when the problem first starts when they're young, then they won't become an adult with a chronic, you know, relapsing, remitting illness who doesn't manage to finish school, doesn't get into the university of their choice, doesn't manage to get into work, and essentially becomes someone who's less likely to be able to be productive, pay into the tax coffers, be economic, you know, help with economic.
But this government says it's doing what it should be doing. You know, if I look at what the Department of Health and Social Care have put out as a statement in response here, it's vital that anyone struggling is able to access timely help and support. We're investing an extra £688 million in mental health services this year, hiring almost 8,000 additional mental health workers, rolling out mental health support teams to every school and college in England. What do you make of that?
Well, you know, we're really pleased that they're doing that. But the reality is it's not quite enough, I'm afraid. So even before the pandemic, there was an increase, as you've said, there was an increase in the number of people who needed mental health support. But unfortunately, we didn't get an increase in the number of people who are available to provide that support. We are under-resourced. We don't have enough staff. We have staffing vacancies of 10 to 15% always. That extra 8,000 staff are... we need them on top of our actual numbers. But each year we're losing 9,000 staff through retirement and people just feeling burned out and feeling that they can't continue. So we're not replenishing the staff.
Which that in itself is a horrible irony that you're trying to help people who are feeling...
Exactly. But everyone's overwhelmed. I mean, we are literally on our knees. And that means that you end up with a bit of a postcode lottery.
So does that translate, sorry to talk across, but does that translate as longer waiting lists, effectively?
Absolutely. I mean, we've got people waiting over 2 years. Can you believe that? We've got children who are waiting over 2 years to be seen. If you're a 12-year-old child and you're waiting 1 or 2 years because you've got a mental health problem, then that's a sixth of your life.
Have you been diagnosed and then you're waiting?
So what happens is that parents will do their best with their children. The child stops going to school, they go to the GP. The GP thinks this is actually something beyond what I can manage. They refer them to child and adolescent mental health services. And then they sit and they wait and they wait and they wait for treatment. And that that waiting in that time, people don't just get better. These aren't like infections where your immune system fights them off. If you don't get treated, things get worse.
I mean, the health secretary is out today talking about, you know, renewed push for people to go towards talking therapies, to, you know, to sign up where they can or access it in whatever you can. Are you able to access that any easier? I mean, the sort of sound around this is that there's greater access, greater support. Is that true?
So there is greater access for talking therapists, but we're talking also about severe mental illnesses, illnesses like bipolar illness, schizophrenia, illnesses that require more specialist input like PTSD. And unfortunately, it's not easy for people to access support for those conditions. It can take up to 9 years for someone to be to receive a diagnosis and treatment for bipolar illness, for example.
Wow, that long?
Yeah, yeah. And in that time, that person hasn't been able to function. They've, you know, dropped out of school. They've broken all their relationships. They're ruining their lives. And unfortunately, if they have got a job, they've probably dropped out of that job and not understanding why.
Do you think the government believes or understands the seriousness of this? And do you think we all do?
No, I mean, that's the problem. That's why this is a silent pandemic. And Alan Milburn said, what's going on in other countries that we're not doing here? The honest truth of the matter is that we're not actually funding and investing in our mental health services. Work from Australia shows really, really well. You invest in mental health interventions for children, young people and their parents, and parents supporting children and young people. And the return on that investment is $4 for every dollar that you put in within 3 to 5 years. So this isn't simply about saying spending money. This is about saying investing money so that your return later on is so much greater. The Australian government said it's basically, they said it's a no-brainer. actually. We need to invest in mental health services so that we can be economically productive.
I mean, there's been a lot done. Let me just play you this, you know, around the stigma of at least trying to recognise it to yourself, but then feeling like those around you will also take you seriously. I mean, it just so happens that our colleagues on Radio 1, they've got a show called Life Hacks. It's a weekly programme dedicated to discussions, trying to be honest around issues affecting young people. You know, we've talked a lot about how young people are affected. Tonight's is particularly special because they have the Prince of Wales on, and who's been talking about dealing with mental health, particularly as a man. Let's have a listen to this.
We need more male role models out there kind of talking about it and normalising it so that it becomes something that is second nature to all of us. And not one person in this world has all the tools for every eventuality your mental state's going to come across. And I like to go around looking for new tools to put in my toolbox when I might need it. And if we look at it like that, it does normalise the idea that the brain just needs sometimes a little bit of help, but we can't expect to have all the answers ourselves, and it's okay to ask for support, ask a mate, reach out, and that becomes just the normalisation process of what's going on inside your head.
There's obviously still, from his point of view, certainly when he's picking what to campaign on, a need to normalise. But I just wonder, from your point of view, you know, going back to your original wording, which is, you know, very serious, a silent mental health pandemic, how else do you think this seriousness can be conveyed?
So there's a difference between mental health and mental illness. We all have mental health. And what we do is that and what the Prince is talking about is trying to support people to be more resilient, to be able to cope with all the life stresses that might hit us as we're going through. But mental illness, that's a different matter. That's when someone has symptoms that are persistent, that are significant, that interfere with them being able to function, that impair their ability to function in the way that, and you can have a severe mental illness like bipolar illness, but actually have quite good mental health because you're managing your bipolar.
So we need to delineate.
To delineate these two things. It's a bit like having diabetes, but you're coping with your diabetes, or having diabetes, you're not managing it. That's the same thing that can happen. And it's really good that people are talking about how do I become more resilient? And we need to practice that, just like we exercise our bodies. So, you know, to get physically fit.
But don't get those mixed up.
Don't get these two things mixed up. And what we're and because people are talking about mental health all the time, they're not really thinking about mental illness. And Alan Bilmer is thinking, what on earth is going on with all these people with this mental illness? It's because only 50% are able to get good care at any one time. If you only fund the services 50%, sometimes you'll get fantastic treatment, sometimes you won't. But I can tell you what we're really good at. When you go into crisis, then we can look after you. Mm. We need to be looking after people early.
Before that point. Dr. Lade Smith, thank you very much. The outgoing president of the Royal College of Psychiatrists.
Thank you.
23 minutes past eight. The original YouTube watch page has been saved for posterity by the Victoria and Albert Museum. Excuse me. It's going to be available for viewing from today. So Jawad Karim, Chad Hurley and Steve Chen, who founded YouTube, uploaded the first ever video to their new video sharing website on the 23rd of April 2005. It's called Me at the Zoo, and it does indeed show Jawad at the zoo, the San Diego Zoo in California. It's had more than 380 million views.
All right, so here we are, one of the elephants. Cool thing about these guys is that they have really, really, really long trunks, and that's cool. And that's pretty much all there is to say.
It's a work of art in itself, isn't it? Chris Stockel-Walker's on the line, technology journalist and author of YouTubers, How YouTube Shook Up TV and Created a Generation of Stars. Morning to you.
Good morning, Justin.
And it feels like quite an inauspicious start, doesn't it? Or a gentle start, let's put it like that.
Yeah, 19 seconds that bequeathed 20 years plus of history that has transformed our lives. So who would have thought that such an uninspiring, unemotional, frankly, quite dull video would have managed to create this massive movement that we've seen since? And obviously now YouTube is a monolith. It is replacing TV, it is replacing traditional forms of media, and you know, increasingly we spend more of our time sat in front of the TV watching it on those sorts of smart TV apps rather than through the phones and, as it would have been way back in 2005, through our desktop computers.
Did they think it at the time? Did they realise how big it was likely to be?
Relatively early on, they did. At first, not necessarily. So obviously, the first video was uploaded in April, but actually the website launched in February on Valentine's Day. So very fitting that it happens on this 21st anniversary that it's entering the V&A. But no, not necessarily. It took a little bit of time, but then once they did, suddenly they had huge momentum and managed to be courted by lots of other companies, not then owned by Google, but very quickly they came in. They were running a competitor called Google Video. Turned out that actually they thought they needed to just buy this sort of young upstart and use that instead to basically build it even more and make it a bigger, bigger platform.
And the watch page that is now in the possession of the Victoria and Albert Museum, and I would say in the possession, it's difficult with digital things, isn't it? They've basically recreated it, is that right?
Yeah, with the help of a design agency, they have basically replicated what it would have looked like, not necessarily on that first day of YouTube either. They have taken a snapshot of it from December 2006, so the view and the look of it had adapted somewhat. But if you go back in time by looking at it through the exhibition, actually, there are an awful lot of things that are very similar to the YouTube page that we would recognize now. So you have in the top left of the screen, the video playing, the sort of iconic scrubbing through that video that you can do to fast forward. You also have on the right-hand side a range of related videos. Of course, now YouTube throws us into this endless torrent of videos and replays them constantly one after the other. So very much a kind of a relic of the past, but also recognisable, I think, to YouTube users these days.
Did it have, once it got going, was it the accessibility that made it such a success? What was the sort of essence of its success? Because there are lots of other social media channels and lots of other very successful ones, but there's something is, as you were saying right at the beginning, there's something particular about YouTube, isn't it?
Yeah, it's worth rooting this in the context of broader social media. So back then when YouTube launched, we were basically all interacting on MySpace. And actually, Facebook really wasn't a thing necessarily at the time. And so generally, the interactions that we had were at most text-based, sometimes the occasional photo or image, but usually not really all that much interaction. And what really YouTube gave us was the ability to converse within video in a way that wasn't capable at the time. Remember, internet speeds weren't what they were back then. I'm speaking to you via Zoom on my phone, and it means that I can be on screen and on camera very, very quickly, relying on mobile internet. Frankly, that is far faster than even the fastest internet that the average person would have had in their home. So the idea of being able to host, then watch videos in a way that would be sort of every day and accessible to all wasn't common at all then. And that is, I think, the thing that really kickstarted YouTube's growth, was bringing that video to the masses and then enabling people to start to communicate and create their own videos at the same time. So turning home videos effectively into these sorts of things that can become, yeah, cultural massive movements.
Chris Stockwell-Walker, thank you very much for talking to us this morning. I should say as well, there is a history of YouTube on BBC Sounds. It's called How YouTube Changed the World. And it's available now.
But what is also available now at 28 minutes past eight is coffee with the sport.
Good morning. Thank you very much. We'll start with football news, and Real Madrid's Champions League playoff tie at Benfica was halted for 10 minutes after Vinicius Jr. reported alleged racist abuse last night. He and his teammates left the field after the referee made the gesture that signals racist abuse following a conversation with Vinicius. The Brazilian forward had just put the Spanish visitors 1-0 ahead, and that was the final score. The Benfica player in question, Gianluca Prestigiani, has now said Vinicius misunderstood what he thought he heard from me. UEFA have just put out a statement saying the official reports are currently being reviewed. Well, tonight, Newcastle United are aiming for the last 16 of the Champions League. They face Azerbaijan side Karabakh in the first leg playoff tie. And Arsenal women host OHL in the Champions League knockout round playoffs. At the Winter Olympics, the Great Britain men's curling team have now lost 4 of their 8 matches in the round robin stage and must beat the USA today, plus hope other results go their way if they are to reach the semi-finals. And 6 Russian and 4 Belarusian athletes will compete under their nation's flags at the upcoming Winter Olympics. It will mark the first time a Russian flag has been flown at a Paralympic Games since Sochi 2014. Now, the last few matches of the group stages of cricket's T20 World Cup are being played over the next few days, with only a couple of places in the last 8 still up for grabs. Australia have been eliminated, while the USA could still qualify. I've just been speaking to the American cricket journalist Peter Della Penna about the positive reaction from fans, pundits and players to the performances of those associate nations, the non-test playing nations, with the likes of Nepal, Ireland, Afghanistan and the USA pushing England, India, Pakistan and Australia to the brink in some of their matches during this T20 World Cup.
You have one standpoint where people are saying, oh, they need to get better, they need more opportunities, but where do those opportunities come from? The scheduling is limited to non-existent, and it's in spite of that, that still teams from that associate realm have performed very admirably in this tournament, and you could argue if USA, for example, had more match opportunities, that instead of coming just short against India on opening night, or you take the case of Nepal going up so close to England, losing by 4 runs, going down to the final ball, if they had more opportunities against these teams, they wouldn't come up just short. They would get over the line, and it would raise the standard collectively.
Afghanistan have done well as well, haven't they? It's been really fascinating to watch. Do you think then that the right number of teams for a T20 World Cup have been there in terms of the associate teams? And why has it, do you think, worked in particular at this tournament?
I'm always somebody who's always pushing for more. So people say, is 20 the right number? I mean, people were saying before it expanded to 20, is 12 the right number? Is 16 the right number? So there's always room for more in my book, because if you remember, Scotland wasn't even supposed to be in this tournament. Scotland did not qualify, and their spot only came about because Bangladesh withdrew, and Scotland is a much higher ranked team than Italy, for example. But on the flip side, you look at some teams that haven't been as competitive, like a UAE, for example, or Canada, and that's the counter argument to that. But if you look at everything balancing out, 20 teams has been justified, and if anything, I would argue for more and not less, but there's nothing wrong with 20 at the moment.
It's an interesting number, and it might be something we come back to in the summer with the Football World Cup. That's expanded from 32 to 48. I think there are something like 104 games happening this summer, so yeah, we'll be interesting to look at the two later. I was also interested to hear about the crowds. I think around 24,000 a couple of days ago for England versus Italy, a match that isn't really one of the biggest games. How well supported have the non-test playing nations been?
Well, the crowds have been phenomenal. I mean, there's the example of that. There's the example of the Nepal games in Mumbai that have all been well supported. I mean, they've been getting 20,000 consistently. I mean, you look at yesterday's match against Scotland, two teams that were already eliminated going into the match. And yet, again, 20,000 people. It's been phenomenal to see the support for teams that have been not only neutrals, but non-test playing neutrals. So the appetite is there in India. I'm not sure how much crowd support there might have been in other countries, but certainly the evidence is there on this tournament as India hosting that there has been no fall off in interest.
And it has made for a fascinating tournament too, hasn't it? Peter Dalapada, thank you very much for joining us this morning.
Thank you, Karthi.
And South Africa are playing the UAE right now. There's commentary on BBC Sounds and Five Sports Extra with Peter and the TMS team.
Karthi, thank you. A look ahead now to a programme coming up at 9. It's Matthew Syed's programme. Here he is.
When I was a boy, my brother Andy and I would constantly nag our father to tell us the story of the lion and the mouse. We absolutely loved it. The tiny mouse who saves the mighty king of the jungle. That tale, and the way my father told it, stayed with me my whole life. In Sideways today, we hear from a former Los Angeles gang member who brokered a peace deal because of a childhood story. Join me, Matthew Syed, for Sideways, in half an hour on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
But before that, keep it here with us on the Today programme, and I can tell you, in terms of the weather, it will begin dry with spells of sunshine, but will turn overcast this afternoon with outbreaks of rain.
You are listening to Today on Radio 4. I'm Avant and Justin Webb. It is 26 minutes to 9. Caroline Nichols has a summary of the news.
Inflation, as measured by the Consumer Prices Index, fell to 3% in the 12 months to January. That's compared with 3.4% in the previous month. The fall was driven by cheaper petrol and diesel prices and an easing in the cost of airfares and food. The BBC understands the government is considering slowing down plans to pay adults of all ages the same minimum wage. Labour pledged in its manifesto to remove discretionary age bans and to increase the wages of 18 to 20-year-olds so they're paid the same as those over 21. The Welsh Secretary, Joe Stevens, told us the delay wasn't government policy. The National Crime Agency has warned the threat to children from online sexual abuse is getting worse, with the number of arrests rising sharply to 1,000 every month. The agency is urging tech companies to step up efforts to tackle the problem. One of the country's leading psychiatrists has warned that there's a silent mental health pandemic in England. The president of the Royal College of Psychiatrists, Dr. Ladda Smith,
said the longer the scale of the challenge was ignored, the harder it would be to overcome, and that funding mental health services for young people created a return for the economy. The Department of Health said it's made almost £700 million of extra investment in mental health services this year.
Thank you for that. It is 25 to 9. Let's pick up on something we were hearing about there in the news. The head of the National Crime Agency warning that the threat to children from online sexual abuse is getting worse. Many images now being found on social media and mainstream platforms as well. And the number of arrests rising to 1,000 every month. Let us talk to Chris Sherwood, who is the chief executive of the NSPCC and is on the line. Morning to you.
Good morning, Justin.
I think people will be surprised, shocked, horrified by that 1,000 a month figure. This is people in this country, is it, who are abusing children who are also here, or what?
This should shock us all, really, Justin. And it's part of an emerging picture that we see in various data from police forces in the Home Office. You know, we an average of 100 child sexual abuse image offences are being recorded every single day. We've seen a doubling in the number of online grooming offences since 2017-18. We've seen a doubling in the number of sexual communication offences involving a child since 2017-18. And last year, we nearly touched 40,000 child sexual abuse image offences across England and Wales. And, you know, to get to a prosecution takes an awful lot of work. So this is the tip of the iceberg. This is a serious issue. And what we're seeing at the NSPCC is rising abuse, but also a changing nature of abuse as a result of technology.
But is it that people are viewing images and feel that they can and that it's easy to do and that that's happening more? Or is it the actual abuse of children that's happening more? Can we tell from these figures?
What we lack in the UK is a proper study on the nature and prevalence of abuse, which is why we have to look at these little individual insights to be able to see what's happening. And let's not forget, behind every one of those numbers presented by the National Crime Agency today is an individual child. And that prevention of that abuse is really important, and supporting that child to recover from it. But this is a concerning issue. And I think technology companies have a lot to answer for here, Justin. You know, the legislative framework to protect children is inadequate. The Online Safety Act only goes so far. And technology is enabling new avenues for perpetrators to reach children. And there's lots that can be done around this. But this issue is only going to get worse because of AI if we don't protect children from AI. Whilst it's now an offence to produce sexual abuse material involving a child through AI, that's going through Parliament at the moment, AI is going to unleash lots of new avenues for perpetrators to reach children.
But what is it that you think the social media companies can do and aren't doing at the moment?
I think social media companies know what the solution is today. They just choose not to do it. It's going to take government action, urgent government action. And there are things the government can do. It could legislate to disrupt the algorithms that the National Crime Agency talk about, which are enabling perpetrators to see this material and to share it with others. They could tackle issues at source as well. You know, we could prevent young people from being able to send and receive and produce harmful images, such as nude images involving smartphones. So we actually know what the solutions are. The issue here, just is the will of government to be able to stand up to these powerful tech companies with their vested interests, their expensive lobbyists, and say this needs to stop.
I suppose it's also the question of privacy, and particularly if you have age verification and all the rest. And we've already come across this in other areas, that there is a risk that something where people feel that they ought to have the right to be able to do things in private becomes impinged upon by government and by the companies themselves.
Companies love to promote the privacy debate because it's a way for us not to have the real debate here, which is we can balance privacy and protecting children and young people. I mean, some of the mechanisms I've already talked about involving algorithms and not enabling children to send, you know, harmful material and receive it on their smartphones don't impinge upon privacy. But the tech companies like to raise the privacy debate because actually what we see is they don't want to take action. We know that even their own rules, which say that children under 13 shouldn't be on social media platforms, that's their own rules. Today, there are 2.5 million children using those social media platforms. They could take action today to protect children. They choose not to do so, which is why it's going to fall to government. Government needs to stand up and say, no, this needs to change.
Chris Sherwood, Chief Executive of the NSPCC. Thank you very much.
It's 20 to 9. Right now at the Globe Theatre in London is a play called Deep Azure, written in 2005 by the late actor Chadwick Boseman. You'll know that he was the Oscar-nominated actor, probably best known for starring in the Marvel film Black Panther. He died after a battle with colon cancer in August 2020 at the age of just 43. This is the first time his play, Deep Azure, that's the name of it, has been staged in the UK. And it tells the story of how when her fiancé, Deep, is killed by the police, Azure's world spirals out of control. Here's a brief moment from the play where Azure and her friends reminisce about Deep together.
Y'all wouldn't have been in the room if you had any sense.
We had to do community service down at the soup kitchen.
Yeah, that's when Deep started talking about he found his mission. Said if you're only serving self,
that service is in vain.
That is when he started to change.
I couldn't believe it when he took the semester off to follow his call.
Changed his major, stopped smoking, talking about he was high off the spirit. Had his back on most fronts, but on that, he was solo.
I know. I never thought he'd the seminary go.
And he never will, now that he's been killed. Each day the cop's story changes to something stranger.
Well, the director of the play, Tristan Finn Aduenu, reached out to Bozeman's loved ones, including his widow, of course, Simone, his brothers, Kevin and Derek, years ago for their blessing in staging the play. And after a few years, they agreed. And they're now here in the UK to see it. And in Simone's case, for the very first time, I understand, Simone Ledward Bozeman joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
Welcome, well, to the UK, to the Today programme.
Thank you.
What is it like?
I have
the play now.
Yeah, I've seen it twice now.
Okay.
And it is the sweetest of bittersweet feelings I think one could ever feel. I'm overwhelmed, both with pride and the excitement of seeing Chad's words come to life, and also by seeing the reactions of the crowds that have been to see the play and how moved the room is, the spirit that you feel in the room. And the cast is just brilliant.
Because it's based on a true story, isn't it?
Yes, yeah, it's based lightly around a true story. Prince Jones was a Howard University student who in 2000, the year 2000, was shot and killed by police. And Chad was a student at that time and started writing the play then.
And I suppose for you as his widow and, you know, seeing his words these years later and then many years later from when it was written, it must be difficult, bittersweet, as you say.
It is. It is. It's more sweet. It's more sweet than bitter. It really is. I think that it's a beautiful thing to be able to see these elements of his spirit that people have not had the opportunity to see at this point. But you are able to draw the parallels between how he presented himself as an actor and all of the characters he played and this very grand, dignified and regal personage that really truly was him at his core. And now you get to see that through his writing, how
yes.
well that reflects his character and the pieces of him that are brought out in each of the characters in the show.
And the Globe with links to Shakespeare and those sorts of themes must also be, you know, very special.
It does feel like a really beautiful full circle moment to be able to come back here and not only just experience the beauty of the Sam Wanamaker Theatre, which is just, you know, you picture you walk into a room and there's all of this gorgeous warm candlelight and the stage has these silver, almost like chrome. They're very, very shiny orbs all around. So they're reflecting this beautiful candlelight. It's a magical space. And then also to create this, this through line between world communal storytelling that dates back to the griots in ancient Africa to Shakespeare and now to Chad as these pieces of history.
Mm. Yeah. And, I mean, yeah, people still feel close to Chadwick Boseman. You know, they've got these connections through his roles, and you know, he was only 43, and I'm, you know, for you on a personal level, that'll be incredibly difficult to still live with. But I suppose is it in any way a comfort that you have these people around the world who feel connected to your late husband?
It is. It is. I think even early in the stages of grief, sometimes it was a bit overwhelming, but sometimes it really did make me feel less alone.
Yes. And I suppose, you know, you've got the privacy element and wanting to guard against him not having anything out there that he wouldn't have wanted. But at the same time, you know, wanting him to still, I suppose there's still these abilities and chances because he wrote things to have creativity out there that's new.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really special. I think it's very important to me that, that people understand the very, very multidimensional and multifaceted aspects of Chad and his spirit, and that we still have an opportunity to be inspired by him and to learn from his work.
And that it wasn't, I mean, Marvel's amazing, but it wasn't only Marvel.
Yeah, yeah. I don't want his life and career to get distilled down to just one thing. He was a writer before he was anything else. I mean, he always had two or three notebooks in a backpack everywhere he went and was writing just...
Were you watching what you were saying in case he was taking the call?
I mean, you couldn't watch enough around Chad. He noticed everything. He picked up on everything. He had so many bands of intelligence going at one time. He was really, really pretty amazing. Amazing.
It's lovely to meet you. I'm happy the trip's been a good one and you've enjoyed it. You've seen the play twice. But for those just joining us, the play is called Deep Azure, or if you missed it at the beginning when I introduced, and it's on at the Globe Theatre. Simone Ledward-Bozeman, thank you.
Thank you.
14 minutes to nine. A new TikTok trend is called China Maxing. It's leading to a new assessment of Chinese soft power. China Maxing involves young people, particularly Americans, adopting Chinese customs and life habits, drinks, rituals, etc., etc. Cindy Yu is on the line, columnist, contributing editor of The Times and The Sunday Times. Morning to you.
Morning, Justin.
And you say in a piece of the paper, my heritage is trending, which you didn't expect to see.
No, exactly. As a Chinese Brit who's been living in the UK for over 20 years now, it's always been Japan and South Korea that's been the kind of soft power powerhouses of Asia. And actually things that are Chinese were kind of vaguely uncool, as I experienced as a young child growing up here. And now it's our day has come.
What are those things, though, that were uncool and are now suddenly not?
Well, look, it is all quite stereotypical as well. Things like wearing slippers inside the house rather than your outdoor shoes. One of the things I take most issues with the white majority in this country. Things like having hot water rather than cold water. Maybe doing some bit of Tai Chi. Listening to Chinese music. As I say, all of these are very stereotypical. We are living in a meme culture where all of this is meant to be stereotypical because people are joining in the fun in obvious ways. So far be it from me to say that that's all there is to Chinese, Chinese.
And the memes are huge, aren't they? I don't even call it Chinatown anymore. I just call it town, etc., etc. That's how Chinese my mind has become.
Yes, exactly. And you can tell from that it's pretty bonkers, but it is all quite funny. And I think fundamentally it's quite stupid. Obviously, people can't become Chinese, but I actually see it as a way that Gen Z are maybe fighting back against the millennial wokeness, quote unquote, of ideas that you can't appreciate this kind of culture. And it's hard to quantify how big they are, but you know, all you need to do is go on to TikTok, Instagram or even X and type China Maxing and you'll find all sorts of stuff like this.
It's interesting you say that about millennial wokeness. So there's something sort of slightly subversive about it, maybe more subversive because it's a communist country, etc., etc., and I was going to say an enemy, an adversary, let's put it that way, of the United States. Does that make it more interesting, more edgy?
I think so. It's always hard to be scientific about this, but I started tracking this trend early last year when American TikTok users, you know, these 20-somethings, were facing a TikTok ban under the dying days of the Biden administration. And in response, they said, you know, what else can we go to? Let's go to Red Note, which is kind of a Chinese social media app. A bit of a mix between TikTok and Instagram. And then there was this whole, you know, flood of TikTok refugees, American young people finding Chinese young people on Red Note, comparing their lives, basically, looking at each other. And, you know, over time, those refugees went back to TikTok. TikTok was never shut down. But it seemed that from there, you know, they could see what it was like to have youth culture in China in a way that wasn't mediated through establishment media or their politicians. And there's a subversiveness to that because they're saying, you know, we are seeing an image of China that is not what you're seeing.
On a final point then about mediation, I mean, is there potentially a sinister side to this? And as much as people are being encouraged into it by the Chinese government, it's quite difficult to organise virality isn't it?
Yeah, and I don't really think that a propaganda department in China is au fait enough to do something like this, although they would probably welcome it. But I think that the warning I would give to young people is that, you know, China's a big country, it's a complicated country. Just because you see the tall towers of Shanghai, for example, or the Peking duck or whatever it is, doesn't mean that there's not true, you know, flaws and ugly sides and things that we need to care about and talk about, that actually you risk kind of whitewashing if you only think it's a tourist site or something like that. So, I mean, that's the age-old balance between lauding and admiring a culture and understanding that actually there are darker sides there as well.
Cindy Yu, nice to talk to you. Thank you very much.
It's 10 minutes to 9.
Taking on the main role in a play can be daunting in the West End, playing all 23 characters, pretty much testing the limits. Cynthia Erivo, the award-winning actor, singer, doing just that in the retelling of Bram Stoker's Dracula. The reviews, well, they've been mixed. The solo performance uses video to help the performance along, with some parts pre-recorded. It's directed by Kip Williams. His last production, The Picture of Dorian Gray, used similar techniques, actually, with the actress Sarah Snoot playing multiple characters. Angie Wovkowski is on the line, the theatre and dance editor at Time Out, who has seen it. Morning to you.
Good morning.
What do you make of it?
I was mixed on it. I'm a big fan of Kip Williams because I think what he's doing with video on stage is really fascinating and maybe even sort of quite sort of necessary to the future of theatre. At the same time, I don't think what he did here really worked, and it kind of left, you know, you had Cynthia Erivo coming back for the first time in a decade to the London stage. I suppose it's meant to be her sort of big homecoming, and then you've got, you know, this sort of small actress at the front, just dwarfed by these huge pre-recorded versions of herself, and I sort of found myself you know, sort of not quite tuning out, but certainly kind of thinking this didn't work as well as the Sarah Snook Dorian Gray at all.
Is that the problem, the pre-recording?
For me it is. I was talking to some colleagues last night who all had very different opinions, but for me, yes, you know, you had this situation where she's playing five characters all at once, for instance, and it's very smartly done. You know, that there's her as one of the characters. She's doing it live, and that's mixed with pre-recordings of her. But if the character who she's playing live isn't really doing much, then, which for a lot of the time he's not, it's the Doctor, John Seward, so he's just sort of stood at the back, sort of staring in kind of confusion at what's going on, and you've got all these pre-recorded versions of her handling the main action. And then for me it was just a bit odd, really, like you were watching a film that wasn't quite working.
How dark is it?
It's reasonably dark. It's very faithful to the book. I don't think, in fact, I was having an argument with a friend about whether it was meant to be scary. I mean, I think the opening passages where Jonathan Harker goes to Transylvania and you know, falls in with Dracula for the first time is quite scary. After that, I think because of the, I mean, for me, some of the sort of more ridiculous wigs and things she's wearing in the pre-recording did give it a note of silliness, and certainly there was an archness to Dorian Gray that was sort of somewhat carried over here.
Yeah, interesting. Well, people can see it if they want to, and that's only one view, but it is a very interesting view and an informed view, because Andrzej Wachowski has seen it. So, Andrzej Wachowski, thank you. And Dracula is on. I would say where it is on, but I'm not quite sure. Actually, I'll maybe get back to you before the end of the programme if you are keen to see it. It's at the Noel Coward Theatre, I'm told.
There you go. 7 minutes to nine from the Globe to the Noel Coward. But we're taking you around some of the theatres. Let me tell you, from nine on Radio 3, to take you somewhere else entirely, Unwind, Dr. Sean Williams, as she notices some unexpected sunbeams while out on a stroll, will be surrounded by beautiful music. So you can just go and check that out on Unwind on Radio 3, or look for it on BBC Sounds. But at 6 minutes to nine, let's have a listen to some other music. That is a snippet from Look Mum No Computer performing live on a modular synthesizer his song Night or Day. The YouTuber and experimental singer-songwriter will represent the UK at the Eurovision Song Contest in Vienna in May. What do we think? I'm helped in this mission of understanding if this is a good move or not, and certainly who this musician is. Scott Bryan is here to help, TV critic and broadcaster. Morning, Scott.
Morning.
And Dr. Phil Harding, music producer, is also on the line. Welcome to you, Phil.
Morning.
Scott, to you, tell us a bit more about the story here. Get us into the scene of this.
Yes, yeah, certainly. So Look, Mum, No Computer is the entrant, also known as Sam Battle. He's a electronic artist and tech creator. He has his own museum in Ramsgate, which is full of musical machines. He's known for, of course he does. Who hasn't got one? So he's known for taking apart things, putting them back together for maybe a different use and creating music out of them. So most notably, he made an organ out of Furbies. So when you press on a different button, a Furby emits a different noise. If you want to go down a YouTube rabbit hole, you certainly can. And I think his music is incredibly creative. He's already built up quite a considerable social media following, which I think helps galvanise people to go and vote. But I mean, I think it's clear to say that this is a departure from Eurovision entrants from the UK in recent years, which have been more sort of mainstream conventional pop, but haven't really resonated with the audience. Of course, Sam Ryder, the exception.
That's quite a diplomatic way. Yes, I was going to say, but the rest of the performance hasn't,
Sort of about 18th, 19th. So not nil point per se, but not the sort of the knockout that maybe the BBC were anticipating.
Let me bring in Phil at this point. Phil, is it any good?
Well, this is a very bold move by the BBC, and I think it could well be a very good choice, because I think Eurovision fans and the people in Europe watching the programme and so on will see him as a novelty act, and that sort of thing goes down very well at the Eurovision final.
Why do you think that is?
I think people around Europe take it a lot more seriously than we do. I mean, we consider it kind of a bit of fun, but Eurovision fans and hardcore Eurovision fans all around the world, you know, do see it as a fun programme. So that's why making a departure from mainstream pop is probably a very good idea, in my view.
Do you like it? What's your take? Because I suppose if you don't have the story and you just hear it, and especially when you hear things on the radio rather than seeing any of the visuals, it's quite a neat experience, quite naked to it, to just listen to it.
It is. I mean, I like electronic music, and you know, I like what Sam has done so far. We haven't heard the actual song that's going to be chosen, so
that's a good point.
we have to reserve judgment until then. No, but I think he'll be an exciting act, and the fact that he's popular on social media and his YouTube channel, that brings some similarities to Sam Ryder, who was very popular in those similar kind of areas. My only thing is that other countries around Europe still do the traditional national final, which we used to do, and gives the public a chance to vote on five or six artists and songs. And I wish the BBC would consider getting back to that.
Do we not trust the public, perhaps, after Boaty Boatface? Scott, what do you think? You're very good at collating some of the best moments of the year across TV and radio.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it would be a good idea if maybe there was a bit more transparency within this project, but perhaps the fact that we haven't had a knockout winner since 1997 suggests that it doesn't really matter either way. I sort of think that at Eurovision, you just have to stand out. It's a very crowded market. You've only got 3 minutes to be performing your song within, and I think it's sort of going in two different directions. You have mainstream commercial pop artists who are performing at Eurovision, but then you also have, on the other end, kind of complete and that utter absurdity. I think I remember at Liverpool when Loreen won, you know, which was a very mainstream sort of artist. Second place was Carrier from Finland, which had the human centipede bit on stage and turned into a sea shanty. So I think that sort of highlights the two directions that Eurovision goes in.
I must have missed that. Did that make
it huge? I mean, hugely popular with the public too.
I didn't know what you were going to say when the centipede turned into a sea shanty. I, having not seen that, I feel bad. You know, I try and keep up with the popular culture or whatever else is going on, even if it's not my thing. But you're right, though. People care deeply about this, don't they? And then they have their parties. In terms of a cultural moment, Scott.
I mean, I think certainly. I mean, in this sort of year's Eurovision, I think certainly been overshadowed by the fact that, you know, Israel is not, well, Israel is participating, some other countries have said.